accused of helping the hijackers.
Either an officer or an employee or an operative of the Saudi intelligence service.
He was a spy.
He was a spy.
A 9/11 story presented by me, Jane McMullen, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of August. This is Today with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett.
The headlines today: Ofgem is expected to raise the price cap for energy bills to a 3-year high. The regulator will make an announcement in an hour's time. We'll speak to an Ofgem director after the news at 7 o'clock. Music stars and fans around the world have been describing their love for the Queen of Country, Dolly Parton, who died yesterday. Over the course of the programme, we'll hear from friends and admirers of Dolly and from her own appearances on Today.
Daddy got to live long enough to see the dream come true, and he was so proud. I kept him involved with me, and that gave him a sense of pride, and it overcame that feeling. And Daddy got such a kick out of hearing the kids call me the book lady, and he was prouder of that than he was the fact that I was a big country music star.
Well, she was many things to many people, but talking there about the Imagination Library here on the Today programme, Dolly Parton, who died yesterday aged 80, her publicist confirmed after a short spell with cancer, and many of her quips we'll be reminding ourselves of today because she was such a wit too. The higher the hair, the closer to God, a personal favourite. Also in today's programme, Gordon Brown on the breakdown of the New World Order and civic life and his plan to defeat populist nationalist parties. And I'll be speaking to the father of a civil servant, and I have been speaking, I should say, in the Treasury, who killed herself after being called in for an erroneous disciplinary hearing.
It's just devastating. It hasn't torn us apart, but it's torn such a big hole in our lives for what can only, in our mind, it's still perceived as possibly office gossip.
Talking of and remembering Chloe Moffat. And the novelist Robert Harris will be on the programme explaining why he's returned to ancient Rome for the first time in over a decade. Plus, Dame Prue Leith will be talking to us about her campaign to put an end to school lunchboxes and what's inside them, I should say. Though a switch to cooked school meals is not without its critics.
Pizza, pasta, pizza, pasta, pizza, pizza, pasta. And I get quite bored of that every day.
I bet you're doing a bit block too. Right, the BBC News first, though, is read by Jane Steele.
The price cap that will determine energy bills for millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales this winter is due to be announced in the next hour, with forecasters warning costs could hit a 3-year high. The limit set by the industry regulator Ofgem covers bill payers who aren't on fixed tariffs from October until the end of December. Our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey reports.
Suppliers say that at the moment the typical household pays about £600 a year more than it did before Russia invaded Ukraine. This increase has contributed to unpaid bills and charges, which firms expect to total £7 billion by the end of the year. The latest predicted increase in the price cap is forecast to be around 4%, which will hit tariffs which aren't fixed in October, just as temperatures fall and the nights draw in. The government's cut in VAT on electricity bills will kick in at the same time. It will save the typical household about £50 a year, but will be outweighed by rises in wholesale gas costs, pushing up bills in many homes. Any increase is likely to intensify pressure on the government to help those most in need. There are widespread demands for a discounted tariff to be introduced for the most vulnerable, funded by taxation.
American flags are flying at half-mast across the US to mark the death of the country music legend Dolly Parton. She died yesterday at the age of 80 after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. Fans around the world have been sharing their memories of the singer, who was best known for hits including 9 to 5, I Will Always Love You and Jolene. Our correspondent Helena Humphrey is in Dolly Parton's home city of Nashville.
Away from the noisy honky-tonk bars, there's a mood of quiet reflection outside the Country Music Hall of Fame here in Nashville. Around Dolly Parton's star, candles and flowers are being left for the Queen of Country Music. 7-year-old Nash played a rendition of Coat of Many Colours on his violin. The song tells the story of Parton's impoverished childhood. And many here speak not just of her music, but of how she used her success to help others. including through her Imagination Library charity, donating millions of books to children in the US and UK. In a country that often feels divided, Dolly Parton was a rare unifying figure, admired across generations and politics.
Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems after being sexually abused as children. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has apologised for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis. Our health correspondent Nick Triggle reports.
It's estimated around 9% of adults were sexually abused during their childhood. Such trauma increases the risk of mental health problems later in life, including alcohol and drug misuse, self-harm, complex PTSD and depression. But the Royal College of Psychiatrists say victims who come forward for mental health support are being failed. Staff are too focused on treating patients' immediate symptoms rather than exploring the impact of traumatic childhood experiences. The college says support is improving, but better training and more investment is needed.
NHS England says specialist support is available to people who suffered sexual abuse and additional training is being provided to mental health teams in schools and colleges. Officials in Pakistan say 14 children have died in a fire at a hospital in the capital, Islamabad. The fire is reported to have been caused by a fault in the air conditioning systems. The boss of Instagram, Adam Mosseri, has been giving evidence in the high-profile trial of the tech giant Meta in California. 29 US states claim that the firm, which owns Facebook and Instagram, designed its products to be addictive to children and then hid research from the public. Meta has consistently denied the allegations. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports from the court in Oakland.
Giving evidence, Mr. Mosseri acknowledged that after the 2021 release of the so-called Facebook files, documents leaked by a whistleblower, the company reduced the number of employees who were made privy to sensitive internal research. The Facebook documents included internal research first reported by the Wall Street Journal, showing Instagram negatively affected the mental health of some teenage girls, but that the company downplayed those impacts in public. Mr. Mosseri said many of those files had been taken out of context. Later, he was asked whether he knew employees were limiting the information that got to him for legal reasons. He said it didn't surprise him that people were careful, but said he never encouraged his teams to restrict the information that he saw.
Broadcasters in the US are predicting a victory for Darlene Graham, the sister of the late Senator Lindsey Graham, in the Republican primary for the US Senate in South Carolina. Ms. Graham's brother died suddenly last month, prompting a race to replace him on the ballot in the upcoming midterm elections. Her victory would be seen as a win for President Trump, who campaigned for her. A new analysis suggests smokers have a better chance of quitting if they use vapes containing nicotine rather than patches or gum. The Cochrane Review of the latest trials and research also found the use of e-cigarettes was more successful than support programs for smokers who want to give up. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health officials advise adult smokers wanting to give up to switch to nicotine-based e-cigarettes. They say smoking tobacco is much worse for your health than vaping. This review of e-cigarette use supports this view. The authors found that 6 in 100 smokers gave up after using nicotine replacement therapies such as gums and patches, but of those who vaped, 10 in 100 quit. The review said while vaping to quit wasn't risk-free, there was no evidence of increased serious harm, though more research was needed.
Hugh Pym reporting.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. 6:08. It's time to go over to the BBC Weather Centre where Thomas Schaffernaker has some news for us. Hi, Thomas.
Hi there, Amol. Well, some of us will get rain today, but there will be very big differences over short distances. Showers and thunderstorms, which will be developing through the course of this morning and this afternoon, will be very hit or miss. So there's no guarantee that you will get the rain. In fact, some of us will miss the rain showers altogether, and it will be a dry and mostly sunny day, which is not necessarily good news because it's so dry. But as far as the here and now is concerned, there is some rain in Northern Ireland. That should peter out this afternoon. There might be the odd shower, but I think it's a mostly cloudy day here. Temperatures in Belfast will be about 20 degrees. And in Scotland, any showers that do develop will be generally in the southwest of Scotland. That means that the bulk of Scotland, certainly northern, central and eastern areas, should be dry and quite sunny today, up to 22 Celsius in Edinburgh. In Wales, the showers could be almost anywhere. generally inland, so coastal areas should be dry. Cardiff should warm up to 25 Celsius. And then in England, the most likely area where the showers will form is, say, from just north of London through the Midlands into the Peak District, across the Pennines, and I think into Lancashire and Cumbria. So those sorts of areas, that general area, could see those storms developing elsewhere across England. I think we are in for a mostly sunny day with scattered fair weather clouds and quite warm and relatively humid too. 27 in London, 23 in Manchester, and for most of us it will be around the 20s. The bigger showers, more widespread ones, arrive tonight and into tomorrow. That's when you're more likely to catch them.
Thomas, thanks very much. 6:10. Let's turn our attention to the news about a rare unifying figure across America, where flags are flying at half mast across the country to mark the death of the country music legend, songwriter, actor, theme park owner and philanthropist, Dolly Parton. From Donald Trump to Barack Obama, Oprah Winfrey to Mick Jagger to Jane Fonda, Bette Midler could carry on. The tributes are flowing and fulsome for a woman who once said, "I'm not offended by the dumb blonde jokes because I know I'm not dumb and I'm not blonde either." Dolly Parton died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. In 2024, here on the programme, we spoke to Dolly's niece, Jada Starr, when Dolly did a documentary looking at her Welsh roots, and the legendary singer herself sent us this voice note.
"Hi there, it's Dolly Parton, and I'm tickled pink that you're so curious about my UK roots. I can't give away all the secrets just yet. You'll have to tune in to our documentaries later this year to find out all the juicy details. Hey, thank you for having my wonderful niece Jada on the show today. You'll be sure to listen to her new record. It's good."
Ever gracious, ever the saleswoman. Well, earlier I spoke to the BBC's LA correspondent, Shaima Khalil, and I started by asking about Dolly Parton's role as this rare unifying figure in American public life.
She is. And I think what's really remarkable, Emma, is when you look at the reaction that's been coming out throughout the day, all the way from President Trump through Hollywood, the entertainment industry, and President Trump and the entertainment industry, especially Hollywood, don't really agree on much. These are like two polar opposites. And yet, they are connected and they are unified in their sadness of the loss of Dolly Parton. She is really a rare unifying figure in that one of her colleagues, a country music artist today, was saying, you know, she was one of the very few things that we could agree on, and I don't know what we're going to do now. And it just shows you that she crosses these political divides. She crosses generations. I found it extremely remarkable today as I was on Hollywood Boulevard throughout the whole day speaking to people. How many young people were there laying flowers, visibly emotional and sad about her loss? There was this young 21-year-old, his name was River, and he looked distraught while he was laying down that bouquet. And I said, wait a minute, you're so young. I remember her because I grew up with Jolene. I grew up with Coat of Many Colors. How do you know her? And he said, look, she spoke from the heart. She spoke about women. She spoke about the LGBTQ community. She made sure to give positivity, to make people happy. But I was introduced to her through my aunt. It was fun to dance to her music, to sing her music. But when she talked about heartbreak, I really felt it. That was a 21-year-old in front of Dolly Parton's star today.
It's incredible, isn't it? That connection that she had. And I read a brilliant and heard a brilliant line about her from a professor and writer who'd followed her, Helen Morales, who said she had this insistent witnessing of women's lives. When you look at what she was writing about, long before people talked about such things, whether it was adoption, whether it was mental health, whether it was domestic abuse. Yes, there's Jolene and I Will Always Love You, but there was pain all the way through those songs and people's real lives.
And truth, I think, and I think this is why it transcended, because when she spoke about heartbreak, when she spoke about struggle, you really felt it. And that doesn't happen with many celebrities. There are so many artists out there that speak about those things, and it doesn't come through. People say, well, you know, what do you know? And that doesn't happen with Dolly Parton. And the other thing, I think, is that, you know, where I am right now in Hollywood, we throw that word authenticity and authentic around so many times. Everybody wants to be authentic. Everybody claims to be authentic. And yet, this woman who shows up completely made up to the T, the rhinestones and the glitz and the big wigs and the red lipstick,
And yet she connects on a much deeper level with so many people across generations. And that is a feat I don't think many can claim to have, and she did.
That's why, you know, people are flocking, as you say, of all ages to the Star in Hollywood and to other places. There will be pilgrimages and commemorations throughout the world today.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. And it also tells you, when I was there, first of all, that Star is now nearly completely covered with flowers. There's a big wreath. But there were also little things that are so very Dolly. Someone left a magic wand with pink rhinestones. Someone else left a box of Dolly Parton's cookies, you know, and the box was pink and red. And then this woman came and she laid down a small thing. And then I went and looked at it and it was red lipstick. And I said, what was that? And she said, well, it's Dolly, isn't it? She loved it. She would have been smiling now. She loved the glamour. She taught me to never be afraid to put on a show. And I think, you know, she will be remembered for a lot of things. She will be remembered for the music, of course, the multi-Grammy awards, the couple of Oscar nominations, the, you know, that smile and radiance, the philanthropy, of course, and the Imagination Library. But I think the one thing that is crucially Dolly Parton is that she will be remembered for being so unapologetically human and real and herself, and for encouraging people to feel the same.
The bigger the hair, the closest to God. Or when asked, how long does your hair take to do? She goes, I don't know, I'm not there. The queen,
yes, I'm never there, right?
I'm never there. The queen of one-liners as well. And always getting to the joke before the joke was made of her, and her, you know, laughing with people, I suppose, as well. So many things we could say, but thank you for giving us a flavour, Shaima, of the commemorations and why people are turning out and having this rare moment of connection, especially in America. Shaima Khalil.
Loved that. 16 minutes past six, time for a look at the papers. And unsurprisingly, there's one person who appears on almost all of the front pages. We've just been hearing about her. It's Dolly Parton. The Sun, the Daily Mirror and the Daily Star all share the headline, We Will Always Love You, Dolly. To the eye, she was the legendary queen of country who wanted to be remembered as a songwriter. The Guardian leaves little doubt about whether she achieved that, noting she was so gifted that she wrote two of the 20th century's greatest songs, Jolene and I Will Always Love You, in a single day.
Burnham warned of impending Russian-UK attack, declares the Daily Mail on its front page. It says the Prime Minister has been told by security experts to be prepared for a direct response from Moscow over Britain's support for Ukraine. The former Conservative Defence Minister Tobias Elwood tells the Daily Express Russia will seek to exact a price.
According to the Times, Andy Burnham is poised to announce sanctions on Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, despite warnings from within his party that the measure could spiral into a de facto boycott of Israel itself. The government tells the paper it won't comment on speculation.
The Financial Times leads on China's criticism of fresh US sanctions, which aim to isolate Iran's economy. The paper says any attempt to expand the sanctions regime to Chinese companies would risk retaliation from Beijing. The FT points out that President Xi Jinping is due to meet Donald Trump in Washington next month.
The Daily Telegraph reports that Birmingham, once regarded as the motor capital of Britain, is set to become England's first 20-mile-per-hour city. It says the council, led by a coalition of the Green Party, the Liberal Democrats and Independents, wants to introduce the speed restriction on all routes other than A roads. The Reform UK opposition calls it an anti-motorist policy. A spokesperson for the local authority tells the paper, our message is simple, slower is safer.
It's 18 minutes past six, and now let's get the latest on business, because this morning households will find out about how much their energy bills are set to change ahead of the winter, I should say. So very personal business and linked directly to the cost of living and how everybody's trying to make it work. Leanna Byrne is here with that and all of the rest of the business news. Morning, Leanna.
Morning, Emma, and also morning, Amal. So, yeah, that's right. The latest forecast from Cornwall Insight is for Ofgem's household energy price cap to rise by about 4% in October. That's taking a typical annual bill to about £1,729. That's the highest since July 2023. And we've talked a lot recently about how the conflict in the Middle East has pushed up wholesale energy prices. But new research from Boston Consulting Group suggests those wholesale prices are actually becoming less important in determining what we actually pay for electricity. It says a growing share of the bill now comes from things like maintaining and expanding the electricity grid and other changes added to the bill. So Raoul Rapparel is with me, formerly a special advisor to Theresa May when she was Prime Minister and now director at the Boston Consulting Group's Centre for Growth. Good morning.
Good morning.
So before we get into why bills are rising, when I pay my electricity bill, what am I actually paying for?
So paying for a variety of things. As you say, you're paying for the wholesale cost of generating that electricity, but you're also paying for the network costs, so the cost to build out the infrastructure, the grid. You're paying for some policy costs, so warm homes discounts, some of the renewables obligations to support the renewables build out. You're paying for some of the operating costs within the system, what it costs to run the system. Obviously, there's an element of taxes, VAT, which has been temporarily reduced later this year. And then there's a small kind of profit margin, but a variety of things of which wholesale cost of generating the electricity is just one part.
So why are wholesale prices becoming less important?
So I think all those other factors that we mentioned there that go into the bill are taking on a bigger share. I think if we look back over the past decades, wholesale prices have explained just over a third of the rise in bills. But the network and policy costs components that I mentioned explain around 45% of that rise. And when we look forward over the next decade, we think bills in our core scenario, in a scenario in line with the Department for Energy and Net Zero, will rise by around £115 per year for the typical household. And of that rise, I think the network costs will drive almost 86% of that. So, you know, a significant amount of these fixed costs in the form of network, policy, taxes are taking on a larger share of the bill and also accounting for more of the rise.
How does Britain compare to the rest of Europe?
Well, I think we stand apart on electricity in particular. So our domestic electricity prices are the fourth highest from developed European countries. Our non-domestic electricity prices are the highest, so business prices. And that compares to gas prices. So our domestic gas prices are the lowest and our industrial gas prices are around the median of our peers. So we really are an outlier on electricity. And, you know, the electricity to gas price ratio is around 4.2, which is about 60% above some of our peers. So our electricity is materially more expensive than peers and more expensive than gas in this country.
There's a vicious cycle, isn't there, that I want you to explain to me, because people use less electricity, but that can actually make each unit more expensive, can't it?
Yes, exactly. Because we have these fixed costs that we talked about in terms of the network, the grid, the policy costs, the taxes, they are spread over the system as a whole. But when prices are high, people will use electricity. Businesses in particular will use less electricity. But these fixed costs don't go away. So they are maintained and they're just spread over less usage and fewer users. And so I think the concern is looking forward that this negative demand price spiral could cause bills to rise further. Because as we see more of these fixed costs coming into the system, if demand continues to flatline or decline slightly, as it has done over the past decade, those fixed costs will be spread over fewer and fewer people. And that means the unit costs and bills for those that remain and the usage that remains will go up further.
So are we essentially paying more now in order to have cheaper and more secure energy in the future?
Yeah, I think that is essentially the idea, that we are moving to a system where we have more secure and more renewables, more domestic production. We are more insulated from gas price shocks and the global gas price setting. And we have the grid and the network that can provide that to where it's needed across the country and account for more storage, etc. So that is what we're moving towards. But that takes, you know, 20 plus years to get there. And I think what also matters is the path that we get there and what happens to prices in the interim. And our suggestion is that the combination of falling demand and fixed costs coming due at this point in time risk creating a worsening negative spiral. And therefore, there's quite a strong case to say, can we defer some of these fixed costs into the future to allow demand to grow and to get more demand into the system so that then they can be brought back in the future and spread over a larger usage and therefore cost relatively less across the system as a whole.
Okay, Raoul Rapal, Director at the Boston Consulting Group's Centre for Growth. Thank you so much for joining us. With me now, Micah Curry, Vice President of Personal Finance for PensionB. Micah, let's start with US-Canada tariffs. Canada hit back at the US with what it calls a dollar-for-dollar response to the latest American tariffs. So from the 8th of September, Canada is going to impose tariffs of 15%, 25% and 50% on around 700 US products. It's covering about $27.6 billion Canadian dollars of imports. So broadly, where has Canada hit back at the US?
Well, two-thirds of Canada's exported goods are sold to the US. So this is pretty far-reaching. And it comes at a really risky moment for the US economy, because we know the US is battling sky-high inflation, really stubborn inflation, and there's increased unhappiness among voters over that as we near those crucial midterm elections in November. We know that companies will be forced to pass on those tariffs in the form of higher prices to consumers, and that will only fuel this fire of inflation and the current bond market challenges that the US is seeing. But arguably, Canada is in as a perilous situation because Canada is a far smaller economy than America. America is 13 times larger. And Canada's goods that it sells to America is deeply integrated into American supply chains. So it is going to struggle to find alternative buyers quickly. And the hope really is that both sides can come back to the negotiation table instead of going on what could be a really disastrous trade war between two North American neighbours.
Well, sticking to the US, US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, he's been trying to bring down America's long-term borrowing costs, including by doubling the amount of longer-dated government debt the Treasury will buy back. And traders now have a name for it, what they think is happening. It's called the Bessent Put. But it's interesting, isn't it? That's also having an effect on Bitcoin and gold. Can you explain that to me? Why would that have an impact?
Yes, well, because borrowing costs are so high in the US, the US Treasury is looking to finance that debt by buying its own bonds. And that really is making the market quite nervous, because what we're seeing is a battle between the Treasury and the market, and it's most likely that the market will emerge at the top. So with this uncertainty, with the US Treasury doubling down on buying its own bonds, people are worrying about government debt, they're worried about inflation, and they're moving to scarce assets such as Bitcoin and gold. And that's why we've seen the price of Bitcoin spike. There's been some profit taking and it has come down slightly, but also people moving back into gold. Those two assets that are seen as safe haven assets when we have a lot of uncertainty and we have the world's largest economy slowly embarking on what could be a massive debt crisis.
Okay, Micah Curry, Vice President of Personal Finance for PensionB, thank you so much for joining us. Now, global use of travel eSIMs is expected to jump by almost a third this year as more holidaymakers look for cheaper ways to use their phones abroad. Around 134 million are expected to be used globally in 2026, up from just under 102 million last year. And by the way, an eSIM is essentially a digital SIM built into your phone. So instead of swapping physical cards, you can download a data package, often at a lower price than the roaming deal offered by your usual mobile network. Vikintas Maknikas is chief executive of travel eSIM app Saily and joins me now. So how many people are turning to eSIMs?
I can say for sure that the numbers are in hundreds of millions, because in the last 3 years, we saw a rapid growth in terms of Saily and in terms of the market itself. So there are a lot of people who are trying it out because they see the convenience of being able to switch carriers easily, this way getting better pricing for the roaming specifically.
So are you able to undercut the big mobile operators?
In some cases, yes. So for example, if you are traveling to Japan, you know, your local operator thinks that you are still reluctant to switch between operators, because before eSIMs, the only way to switch for you was to basically switch the physical SIM cards, and it's very inconvenient because you lose your phone number, you don't get text messages, calls from your home, you know, and in some cases you even don't have the contacts on your phone anymore, you know. So people were reluctant to do so. Now with eSIMs, you can basically turn some settings in your phone so your data would go through an eSIM that's downloaded through the internet, and keep your phone number and get text messages, calls from your home, and keep your contacts and so on. So when doing so, you are able to pick the operator you like and the pricing and packaging you like, which was inconvenient before and pricey before.
But presumably the big operators might respond by cutting their own roaming prices, right? So at what point does that start to take away the advantage for companies like yours?
So it's difficult to say, because they don't cut the pricing themselves for various reasons, you know, including the fact that not everyone knows about eSIMs and not everyone knows about travel eSIMs specifically. So we'll see how that will turn out. But for now, we still see rapid growth.
All right. So for now, you're doing well. And that's good. All right. Well, Vikintas Maknikas, Chief Executive of Travel eSIMs app Saily, thank you so much for joining us.
Leanna, thank you very much indeed. 29 minutes past six. Mike Williams is here with the sport. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Amal. We have to start this morning with a humiliating night for Celtic in the Champions League.
Again, and on from the edge of the box, goal! Lasker in front in this time for the first time. Another fabulous strike from range. And incredibly, this tie has been turned totally on its head. From 4-0 down on aggregate, it is now last 5, Celtic 4.
Yes, Celtic went into the second leg of their Champions League playoff tie with the Austrian side LASK last night, 3-0 up from the first leg. They then opened the scoring to lead the tie 4-0 overall, but then promptly collapsed and lost the match 5-4 on aggregate. It means the Scottish champions have failed to qualify for the biggest competition in European football. Here is a crestfallen Celtic manager, Martin O'Neill.
Accept the responsibility that is down to me, regardless, whatever you think it might be, whether it's tactics, whether it's a fitness, it's just everything perhaps, but we shouldn't have done that. And from the position that we were in, we shouldn't even have been going into extra time.
Well, Celtic will now drop into the Europa League, the draw for which takes place on Friday. No shocks in the League Cup second round last night. Leeds, Ipswich, Coventry, Hull amongst some of the sides to progress. You can see all the scores on the BBC Sport website. Meanwhile, the Manchester United captain Bruno Fernandes and Manchester City forward Khadija Shaw were both honoured at the Professional Footballers Association Awards last night, winning Men's and Women's Player of the Year, respectively. Also in attendance at the ceremony in Manchester was Sir Kenny Dalglish. He collected the PFA's Merit Award. It was announced, you might remember back in June, that the 75-year-old is undergoing treatment for cancer, and Dalglish gave the BBC this update on his health.
Cooking with gas, no problem. I'm still breathing, so let's move forward and upwards. You always feel a wee bit humble when you get an individual award, because it's a team sport, and you're kidding yourself on if you don't think it. There's a lot of people made a huge contribution to any award that you get. You're grateful for it, but I realise it's reflection and the people that I've worked with, and because of them I've got an award, so thank you very much, that's very much appreciated.
Sir Kenny Dalglish speaking in Manchester last night. Finally, cricket, and we heard from the England captain Joe Root yesterday for the first time since fast bowler Brydon Carr was dropped from the squad for the second test with Pakistan this week following an incident at a Derby nightclub that ended with Carr in handcuffs.
If I'm being brutally honest, I'm really hacked off. I'm really disappointed that after last week's performance, we're sat here and we're talking about something, nothing related to it at all. And I've spoken to Brydon, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn by saying he's very upset, been very apologetic.
Joe Root pulling no punches there. The second test between England and Pakistan starts at Lord's on Thursday.
There you go, Mike. Thank you very much. We'll be obviously listening into that. And now, what can I tell you? That next week, Phylon 4 will be conducting and investigating the reality, a very serious reality, of doctors at risk of suicide.
I'm Lalit Vijayadoru. As a doctor myself, I know what a medical career can be like.
The system forgets that we are humans.
The stresses, the strains.
I felt really drained and unsupported.
And the sometimes unbearable pressure.
I couldn't function. I couldn't see a future. I made preparations to end my life.
For Phylon 4 Investigates, I'm finding out why one doctor dies by suicide every 3 weeks and what needs to change to prevent it. Medical Emergency on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Tuesday night at 8.
Now the time is 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. Here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
The price cap that will determine energy bills for millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales this winter is due to be announced in the next half hour, with forecasters warning costs could hit a three-year high. The limit set by the industry regulator Ofgem covers bill payers who aren't on fixed tariffs from October until the end of December. Flags across the United States are flying at half-mast following the death of Dolly Parton. The country music legend died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist said was a brief battle with cancer. There have been tributes from across the music industry. Sir Paul McCartney said Dolly Parton was magnificent and unrivalled, while Taylor Swift said a world without her didn't feel possible, real or right. Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems after being sexually abused as children. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has apologised for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis. It is estimated around 9% of adults were sexually abused during their childhood. At least 14 children have died in a fire that broke out in a hospital in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Local media said the fire started on the maternity ward in the building after an air conditioning unit exploded. The Pakistani Prime Minister, Shahbaz Sharif, called it a tragic incident. The boss of Instagram, Adam Mosseri, has been giving evidence in the high-profile trial of the tech giant Meta in California. 29 US states claim that the firm, which owns Facebook and Instagram, designed its products to be addictive to children and then hid research from the public. Meta has consistently denied the allegations. A new analysis suggests smokers have a better chance of quitting if they use nicotine vapes rather than patches or gum. The Cochrane Review of the latest trials and research by a group of international experts also found the use of e-cigarettes was more successful than support programmes for smokers wanting to give up.
Jane, thank you so much. It is 25 to 7. Let's turn to that top story, the Ofgem price cap. We're going to get it after 7 o'clock. We'll be hearing from Ofgem directly at about 9 minutes past 7 after Jane's summary of the news after 7 o'clock. Ian Watson, our political correspondent, is in Westminster. Ian, this is really, I mean, this is cost of living, which we're going to come back to at 10 past 8 as well, is really the central, the top concern of the Andy Byrne government, isn't it?
It is. He's been talking about it a lot. He's been offering what he calls breathing space to people amidst a cost of living crisis. But I think there will be a sharp intake of breath that this energy price cap is going up yet again. Forecasters reckon just under 4%, up to around £1,729 for an average family. That follows on from a 13% increase, of course, at the beginning of July. Now, the government's already reacted to this. One of the first things that Andy Burnham did, of course, was to announce that he'd be taking a VAT off electricity prices for 6 months from the 1st of October. That should save families around £45 a year. But that is wiped out, really, by the rise that's expected in half an hour's time in the energy price cap from the beginning of October. In addition to that, I think there's political pressures on him, some from inside his own party. People will be saying, well, take a look at VAT on gas. Why has that not been reduced? Take a look at standing charges, those parts of the bill that everyone has to pay. And the TUC has been pushing very strongly for him to look at a social tariff, in other words, a discounted rate for low-income households. I'd also expect, Amal, during the course of the day, we'll probably get very familiar arguments from all the political parties as well in the bigger picture stuff about whether there should be a date set for net zero. Conservatives oppose that. Reform UK are against that too. They say they can bring down energy bills in that way. And the government will, I think, restate its position that moving to renewables and to nuclear is the best way sustainably to get prices down in the longer term.
Ian Watson, very good to talk to you. Thank you.
Do you need to quit smoking? A new review has recommended adult smokers who want to quit go to vapes over gums and nicotine patches. But what's the evidence? Hugh Pimms, our health editor. Hugh, what have we found out from this review?
Yes, Emma. Well, the review's carried out by the Cochrane Group. That's an international organisation that looks at the latest trials that have gone in the field and pulled together conclusions. And they looked at 80 trials involving 30,000 participants. And their conclusion is that if you use nicotine patches or gums and you're an adult smoker trying to give up, in these trials, it showed 6 in 100 were successful, but that went up to 10 in 100 for those adult smokers using vapes, and so therefore, quite significantly in terms of the numbers, more effective. And vaping, it was shown in these trials, was actually also more effective than conventional support programmes. So the authors of this report are saying it is an important finding, and it confirms that vaping is effective and that vaping, in their conclusion, is considerably safer than smoking.
It's safer than smoking, but then vaping, how do we think of how safe vaping is? You know, are there concerns that this could get lost in that?
Well, they do say that there was no evidence in these trials of serious harm amongst those who switched to vaping from smoking. They do say more research is needed. You can never say anything is 100% safe, but they emphasise that smoking is really very bad for your health, and there's no evidence that vaping is that bad. They do go on to say that their trials were looking at licensed vapes, e-cigarettes, and there's a lot on the market that's unlicensed, maybe containing toxic substances, and therefore they could cause harm. And of course, this review is not looking at the impact on children. We had a report last week from a Royal College, again emphasising the dangers to children of vaping, the harms, breathing problems and so on that emerge. So that will continue to be a debate. And actually one charity, Asthma and Lung UK, has welcomed the report on adult smokers, but said more needs to be done to severely restrict vapes on the market with flavourings and so on, and attractive packaging, which might bring in children.
Hugh Pym, we're going to look more at this a bit later on in the programme and speak to someone who's actually done this and gone from smoking to vaping, and it's worked so far, but also hear a bit more about this report. Hugh Pym, our BBC Health Editor there, thank you.
It's 7:20. The inquest into the death of the former University of Cambridge professor Jason Arday is due to open later today. The 41-year-old was found dead at an address in Battersea earlier this month. Our correspondent Sean Dilley will be there. Sean, just tell us what exactly will be happening later, would you?
Well, inquests, as we know, happen when the coroner feels they need to investigate the circumstances around how someone's died. So at the very least, we'd anticipate that when the inquest opens up in Southwark later, that the coroner would formally identify the now late Professor Arday and obviously set out some kind of timescale for the inquest, the investigation, if you like, into the cause of death.
And this, just for a quick recap for people, this follows weeks or days of coverage of his past as an academic, accusations of plagiarism that had been made by a particular individual, and then it turned into a broader story really about the University of Cambridge and academia more broadly.
Yes, I think that's right. And again, the health warning we put here is let's talk about what's there on the record rather than intimating in any way the cause of death, which only a coroner can do. But it is right that on the 5th of August, so earlier this month, the then Professor Arday had quit Cambridge University, saying that the questions had gone beyond scholarly disagreement. He said that the level of questioning had been relentless and he felt that he needed to step away. It was 9 days later that he was found dead in an address in Battersea in South London. The Metropolitan Police say that they were called to that address in Battersea and that they were preparing that report for the coroner. But look, yes, I think the important point to bear in mind is that there were some significant allegations initially brought forward by a former Cambridge academic, Nathan Koffnes, who's just been suspended from Ghent University in Belgium, who was accusing Professor Arday of plagiarism within his works. Now, that was something that Liverpool John Hopkins University, that awarded the 2015 PhD to Jason Arday, had investigated historically and said that there wasn't anything in. However, there were investigations ongoing into various claims that he made, not just within academia, but Nathan Koffnes, who absolutely had been let go after making some very controversial comments around race back in 2024 from Cambridge University, had made allegations that he'd also fabricated charitable achievements, such as running 600 miles in 6 days.
Sean Dilley, our correspondent, thank you very much indeed.
7:17.
Let's turn to Gaza and the latest flashpoint over Gaza, which is, in a sense, a rather old one. It's kites, children flying kites. Kites have been in the past used to carry incendiary devices, and Israel has threatened a forceful response to kites rising above Gaza and indeed has complained to President Trump's Board of Peace, which has in turn urged both sides to comply with a ceasefire. Anshel Pfeffer is the Economist's Israel correspondent and a frequent contributor to this programme. Always grateful to have you on. Anshel, good morning.
Good morning, I'm all.
How did children flying kites come to be yet another source of division in this region? It's not particularly a new source, because it, for some time it's been a source of contention, but just how did kites come to be this flashpoint?
Well, it's part of a deja vu, I think, for people, for Israelis living in communities around the Gaza border, back to the situation 3 or 4 years ago, before Hamas's attack on October 7, when there were these waves, as you said, of kites and also of floating balloons coming over the border with incendiary devices and setting light to fields and woods in the area of those communities. And from what we've seen, that hasn't yet been the case. The kites that have come over the last few days haven't been carrying anything. But it does look like Hamas and perhaps other actors within Gaza are trying to play mind games with the Israelis, both with the Israelis actually living there and with the government, which certainly on with 2 months to go before an election is very anxious to show how tough they're going to be with Gaza and not let anything like what happened before happen again. So this is kind of this, I think, is a pretty conscious way of Hamas to provoke the Israeli government in a way in which is kind of hard to see how Israel can respond and still be seen to respond in a proportional way.
And to what extent, Anshul, is the government of Israel responding to American pressure in terms of trying to restrict and reduce the number of military operations it's conducting in Gaza?
Well, we've seen a certain scaling down of the operations, both from the reports that we've been getting, but also from soldiers and officers I've been speaking to. There has been sort of a quiet instruction by the government, certainly not something that they'll admit in public because they'll make them seem weak, but they have instructed the Israeli army to launch fewer airstrikes, to have a slightly lower profile presence closer to the, what's the call, the yellow line or the orange line encroaching into Gaza. So we've seen there, not a full ceasefire, but a scaling down, and we know that that's very much due to American pressure.
Anshul, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on. Anshul Pfeffer, the Economist's Israel correspondent.
14 minutes to seven. People who were sexually abused as children but present with problems later on in life have been failed by the NHS. That's according to senior doctors. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has issued a public apology for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis of people who then seek help in adulthood. Caroline Thompson was abused sexually and psychologically as a child, but only sought help from mental health services in her mid-50s when she developed terrifying nightmares.
I was referred to the psychiatric department in my 50s because I'd had a sudden onset of terrifying nightmares, which felt like I was about to die night after night. And to my astonishment and shame, I was met with disbelief. I was told it was hard to reconcile a previous history of abuse with the fact I'd had a family and a career, and that my symptoms weren't typical because of the delayed onset. And the focus seemed entirely centred on what was wrong with me rather than what happened to me. And this led to an initial misdiagnosis, and I was then referred for inappropriate treatment. And it really felt like I was re-traumatised through every part of the process.
It's Caroline Thompson talking. We're listening to that, and joining us now, Dr. Lardo Smith, former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Is that a familiar case, sadly?
Morning. When children are abused in any way, but particularly when they're sexually abused, it is just dreadful and appalling. And unfortunately, the effects on people who are abused in this way are profound and often lifelong, because often they're abused by caregivers, people they know, people who are in authority, and people that they love. And that affects their ability to develop trusting relationships. And often people don't disclose this abuse for many years. It can be up to 25 years when they're in, as adults. And when they then present to services, and it's not just mental health services, because in fact most people will often present to physical health services, to, you know, the dentist, GP.
Yes.
The response they get is not what's needed. It's really clear that these people have complex trauma, and they have difficulty developing trusting relationships. Yet the services that we provide don't provide that continuity of care. They don't provide, to, you know, that allows the opportunity to develop trusting therapeutic relationships. Often we just provide discrete, short packages of care that just aren't enough.
Well, that's if you get the care at all, Lardo, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, that's just what we're hearing there. And that you also might not get the right care. What do you think is in the importance of making this position so clearly known today?
Well, the fact is that, unfortunately, child sexual abuse is actually much more common than people think. It's estimated that 1 in 10 children has been sexually abused, 1 in 5 girls, 1 in 10 boys, or which, 1 in 6
is,
children.
Which
so
is huge.
1 in 5 girls, 1 in 10 boys.
I mean, it's huge when you just pause for a moment to take that in, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a lot. And inevitably, that's going to have an impact on that individual's physical health, their mental health. And so, therefore, we should already have services that can respond to and meet the needs of this group of people. But our services aren't set up or designed to do that. And these are people who will keep using services because they become ill, profoundly ill, actually. And you've heard from Caroline how it really affected her life, and she was doing really well. Unfortunately, what she was met with was people who didn't fully understand the profound impact of child sexual abuse. Things are improving. Individual clinicians are much better at recognising this now. However, the services that we have are designed not to provide for the needs of this group of people. And that has to change.
And this group of people, NRCSA, if people would like to know how they're sort of described as a group, just in case they are looking to seek help, non-recent child sexual abuse is... It's a recognised thing. I think that's important to say, if you're feeling incredibly alone and like you can't come forward and talk about this. But I remember when we last spoke, it was around children and how difficult it was to meet the need of children at the moment and in the way that services are stretched. I suppose it's one thing to say we need to change our services, we need to provide the right service. But are we able to do this with the current capacity?
You know, we have capacity issues, but the truth is that one of the reasons we have capacity issues is because the way in which we're responding to people's needs is perhaps not the most cost effective, actually, and it's not the most capacity effective. People who have experienced non-recent child sexual abuse still use the services, but they use them again and again and again and again. They keep turning up to the emergency departments. They keep turning up because they feel terrible, terrible things are happening to them. And what we need to do is to get it right, first time. And that might mean allowing people to, when they do come, to have longer periods of therapy, because we know that longer periods of therapy are needed because it takes longer for people to develop trusting relationships, because their very ability to develop a trusting relationship has been essentially distorted and in some cases destroyed when they were very young. And if we were able to do that, that would result in much better outcomes that would be more clinically effective and cost effective in the long run.
Dr. Lardo Smith, thank you as ever for your time, the former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, on this report today, or the apology today around the NHS failing child sex abuse victims in adulthood.
It's 7:08. Well, throughout the programme, as you would expect, we're paying tribute to Dolly Parton. She, in fact, spoke to Frank Cottrell Boyce on his special guest edit of this programme in 2024 about her imagination library and why she first started it.
My dad is the reason that I started the imagination library. My dad couldn't read and write, and he was very embarrassed by that, and it was kind of crippling in a way, but my daddy was really smart. What we call horse sense, or what they call in the city smarts. I got to thinking about something I could do for my daddy, and it always troubled me that daddy was troubled by the fact and embarrassed kind of that he couldn't read and write. And I told him, I said, Daddy, there are millions of people all over this world that didn't get a chance to go to school, and he was one of them. He's from 13 kids himself, and back in the mountains where you have to walk to a school if you can even get there, and then you also have to work in the fields to try to support the rest of the family. And that was true with my dad, so he'd never got to go to school. And I thought, well, I'm going to start this little program, get daddy involved with me. So I had thought, well, maybe if it does good in our county, maybe a couple of counties over. But then all of a sudden it did so well, and they took it statewide. Next thing you know, it's Canada. Next thing you know, it's all over the world in different places. Daddy got to live long enough to see the dream come true, and he was so proud. I kept him involved with me, and that gave him a sense of pride, and it overcame that feeling. And Daddy got such a kick out of hearing the kids call me the book lady, and he was prouder of that than he was the fact that I was a big country music star.
The book lady. Well, Andrew Percy is a former primary school teacher who went on to become Conservative MP for Brigg and Goole from 2010 to 2024 and was instrumental in the setting up of some imagination libraries. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
Just before we get to the work that you did, the libraries you built, it's worth saying you grew up in a northern working class family. Was Dolly a big figure at home?
Yeah, I mean, country music was like, you know, my, if you go to any northern working men's club, you know, you would have a country turn on. I grew up with a dad who, you know, had Dolly on, Tammy Wynette, all the usual country stuff. So I think it's kind of a, I mean, it's very big now again, is country in the UK, but certainly growing up in a northern working class community, country was a big part of that.
How did you come to set up imagination libraries in Goole and in Scunthorpe?
Well, I think it was partly because I was kind of a country fan. And then obviously I'd been a school teacher, and we do know that the evidence is really clear that, you know, children who read with their parents or carers before they start school do so much better in school, because they, you know, develop a, you know, obviously the literacy skills, but also a love of reading and of books. And, you know, I just thought, when I first got elected, I sat down with the Imagination Library folks in the UK who do an amazing job supporting lots of these schemes. And I thought, well, look, you know, I represent an area, the area I grew up in, where, you know, there, you know, we've struggled sometimes with our educational standards, that I wanted to bring that to the area. And fortunately, I had a very good council in North Lincolnshire who agreed to fund one of those schemes absolutely for every child in the area. And, you know, it kind of went from there, and we ended up giving 1 million books away in the end, over 1 million books now. It's still, the schemes are still operating, of course.
1 million books. It's remarkable. You met her, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It was like we were invited, myself and some of the team who helped set it up in North Lincolnshire. And we were, she was performing in Leeds, I think, and we got to meet her. And I was introduced to her, and I, you know, they said, oh, you know, he's a member of parliament. She said, oh, what's that? I said, it's like a congressman, but with less money. But she was just like completely and utterly, like, she was just lovely, really sweet. You know, she grabbed my hand, and, you know, she just was like just everything you, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, in the job I was in previously as a member of parliament, you meet people who are often not what they appear behind the scenes as what they appear in public. But she just seemed to be the Dolly Parton that we all think we know and love, and, you know, behind the scenes.
And we heard in that clip with Frank Cottrell Boyce from his from 2024 about the very personal story, her family history, really, that brought her to the issue of literacy. It's worth saying, and I know, subject close to your heart, Andrew, that the cause endures, doesn't it? Because literacy is in a bit of trouble, reading is in decline, and actually, more than ever, we need kids to get reading and do what Dolly Parton's Imagination Library was set up to do.
Well, we know the evidence is really clear, right? You know, kids who start school with, you know, a love of books and a love of reading generally do better. We know that people who, you know, leave school with better literacy skills generally do better in life. They have a more successful life, you know, they have a more comfortable life, and they live longer. You know, that's what we know about education. And I think the fact that she never forgot those roots in, I think it was Pigeon's Forge in Tennessee, of, you know, a father who was illiterate, she never forgot that. And she wanted to give back through her whole life. And, you know, there are at least 1 million books that have gone out, as I say, in North Lincolnshire, and hundreds of millions, I think, globally, for which she, you know, she will be remembered. And that's a great gift to, and a legacy to leave.
Certainly is. Andrew Percy, former primary school teacher and former Tory MP for Brigg and Goole, thank you so much.
On BBC iPlayer.
There is a problem. A British contractor was shot in Svalbard up in the Arctic Circle.
Put down the gun!
This is DCI Silver.
I know who she is.
We have to keep things contained.
They go to war over this.
This is not the fight you can win.
The Russians are here, and it looks like they've come mob-handed.
Let's all stay calm. Okay, no one needs to get hurt. We need backup.
Amy, no!
The new series of Vigil starts on Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
It is 2 minutes to 7, time for the weather with Thomas Schaffernaker.
Amal, thank you. Showers are brewing, but I think there'll be a lot of disappointed gardeners because there's going to be a lot of variation between one place and another in terms of how much rainfall we get. Now, so far this morning, we've just had spits and spots of rain here and there, but in the last hour, some big showers have been forming across Wales. I think parts of the southeast, especially places like Essex, are in for some downpours in the next few hours. And through the course of this afternoon, we will see further showers developing across the Midlands, further north into the Peak District and into northwestern England, and some will bring thunder and lightning. Elsewhere, I think it's going to be a mostly dry day. In fact, the best of the sunshine will be along the Channel Coast, southwestern England, and also the North Sea coasts, all the way from East Anglia up to the northeast of Scotland should have a pretty sunny day. Northern Ireland, a little on the cloudy side. Top temperatures today, about 27 in London, 23 in Manchester, and for Belfast and Edinburgh, it should be about 20 to 22 degrees. Now, if you do want the rain, and many of us do, we're desperate for it, there is some rain on the way this evening and overnight. Now, tonight, the showers could become pretty widespread. There's some big thunder and lightning potentially on the way into the early hours of Thursday, and through Thursday itself, could be some flash flooding in places. So, big change from what we've been used to so far this summer. So, tomorrow, it's across the southern half of the UK where we'll get most of that weather action. That's it.
Thomas, thanks so much. You are listening to Today here on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of August. The headlines this morning. The energy regulator Ofgem has just announced details of its latest price cap. Bills will rise by 3.6% in October compared with the current cap. We'll be speaking to an Ofgem director after the coming bulletin. Tributes have been paid throughout the night to the country music megastar Dolly Parton, who died yesterday after being diagnosed with cancer. Later this hour, we'll remember her famous set at Glastonbury with Joe Wiley, who interviewed her there.
What's the strangest sight that you've seen? Because there were many people dressed up as you.
Yeah, I know. Well, I see that everywhere. There's a lot of drag queens out there. I always said it's a good thing I was a girl, because I would have definitely been a drag queen.
And psychiatrists have warned that the NHS is failing people who need help with their mental health after being sexually abused as children.
Coming up in the next hour, Gordon Brown on the breakdown of the world order and civic life and his new plan to defeat nationalist populism. And there's a major review, which may be music to your ears, that says that vaping could be the most effective way to quit smoking. We'll be speaking to the lead researcher and also hearing from someone who's gone through this exact situation. But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Typical energy bills for millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales are to rise by 3.6% in October under the latest price cap just announced by the regulator Ofgem. The limit, which will run for 3 months until the end of December, will see typical bills for those who are not on fixed tariffs increase by £60 a year. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachy.
Suppliers say that at the moment, a typical household pays £600 a year more than it did before Russia invaded Ukraine. The increase has contributed to unpaid bills and charges, which firms expect to total £7 billion by the end of the year. This rise in the price cap will hit tariffs which aren't fixed in October, just as temperatures fall and the nights draw in. The government's cut in VAT on electricity bills will kick in at the same time. It will save the typical household about £50 a year, but will be outweighed by rises in wholesale gas, pushing up bills in many homes. The increase is likely to intensify pressure on the government to help those most in need. There are widespread demands for a discounted tariff to be introduced for the most vulnerable, funded by taxation.
American flags are flying at half-mast across the US to mark the death of the country music legend Dolly Parton. She died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. Many of the world's biggest music stars have joined famous fans in paying glowing tributes to the singer, who is best known for hits including 9 to 5, I Will Always Love You and Jolene. Sir Paul McCartney said she was magnificent and unrivalled, while Beyoncé called her the North Star, bold and brilliant, talented and tenacious. The former US President Barack Obama said it was hard to imagine many people having a bigger impact than Dolly Parton. Our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil reports from Los Angeles.
From the moment her death was announced, fans have gathered at Dolly Parton's star on Hollywood Boulevard. Some laid flowers. Others brought farewell messages. Many were visibly emotional. For them, this felt less like the death of a distant celebrity and more like losing someone whose voice was a soundtrack to their lives.
It's really, really terrible. It's really bad. And I don't feel good at all, so...
I was stunned. I was at my desk working, and I had to take a break and stop because I was so overwhelmed with emotion.
She was really full of joy. She really was. Great entertainer. She was funny. She was an awesome lady.
Dolly Parton's music traveled across generations, and her talent crossed genres. Some grew up with Jolene and Coat of Many Colors. Others discovered her through Whitney Houston's recording of I'll Always Love You, or the film 9 to 5, which produced a Grammy Award-winning song of the same name. The rhinestones, the wigs, and the glamour made her instantly recognizable. But behind that larger-than-life image was an artist who connected with people on a much deeper level. Her generosity reached far beyond music. The Imagination Library, inspired by her father, who never learned to read, gave free books to millions of children around the world. In a deeply divided America, Dolly Parton was that rare unifying figure. She'll be remembered for the songs, the stories, and the philanthropy. But perhaps most of all, for being so completely and unapologetically herself.
Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems after being sexually abused as children. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has apologised for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis. Our health correspondent Nick Triggle reports.
It's estimated around 9% of adults were sexually abused during their childhood. Such trauma increases the risk of mental health problems later in life, including alcohol and drug misuse, self-harm, complex PTSD, anxiety and depression. But the Royal College of Psychiatrists has told the BBC that when victims come forward for mental health support, they are being failed. Staff are too focused on treating the symptoms patients present with, rather than exploring how traumatic experiences in childhood may still be affecting them. The college says while support was improving, there needed to be better training and more investment in the UK, as one of the biggest problems is that services don't get the time they need with this group of patients.
NHS England says specialist support is available to people who suffered sexual abuse and additional training is being provided to mental health teams in schools and colleges. 14 babies have died in a fire at a maternity unit at a hospital in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Local media say the fire started after an air conditioning compressor exploded. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis reports from outside the hospital.
The fire broke out on the third floor in the mother and child unit at PIMS Hospital, one of the main state-run hospitals in the capital. According to their spokesperson, 15 newborn babies were in the ward at the time. There has been no official confirmation about what caused the fire to start. Officials say they are investigating. TV satellite vans now line the outside of the hospital's perimeter, waiting for news. Pakistan's Prime Minister has called the fire tragic and expressed his condolences to the families of the children.
The boss of Instagram, Adam Mosseri, has been giving evidence in the high-profile trial of the tech giant Meta in California. 29 US states claim that the firm, which owns Facebook and Instagram, designed its products to be addictive to children and then hid research from the public. Meta has consistently denied the allegations. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports from the court in Oakland.
Giving evidence, Mr. Mosseri acknowledged that after the 2021 release of the so-called Facebook files, documents leaked by a whistleblower, the company reduced the number of employees who were made privy to sensitive internal research. The Facebook documents included internal research first reported by the Wall Street Journal, showing Instagram negatively affected the mental health of some teenage girls, but that the company downplayed those impacts in public. Mr. Mosseri said many of those files had been taken out of context. Later, he was asked whether he knew employees were limiting the information that got to him for legal reasons. He said it didn't surprise him that people were careful, but said he never encouraged his teams to restrict the information that he saw.
An inquest into the death of Professor Jason Arday will be opened in London today. The 44-year-old was found dead at his home earlier this month, less than 2 weeks after resigning from his role at the University of Cambridge. Jason Arday became the youngest ever black professor at Cambridge in 2023, but quit after the university launched an investigation into allegations of plagiarism. He admitted errors in his work, but said he had faced an unrelenting level of public scrutiny and personal attack and was not a liar. A new analysis suggests smokers have a better chance of quitting if they use nicotine vapes rather than patches or gum. The Cochrane Review of the latest trials and research by a group of international experts also found the use of e-cigarettes was more successful than support programmes for smokers who want to give up. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health officials say adult smokers wanting to give up can be advised to switch to nicotine-based e-cigarettes. They say the health harms from tobacco smoking are considerably worse than from vaping. The new review, which looks at the use of licensed e-cigarettes, underlines that. The authors concluded that 6 in 100 smokers gave up after using nicotine replacement therapies, such as gums and patches, but of those who vaped, 10 in 100 quit the tobacco habit. And they said while vaping was not risk-free, there was no evidence of increased serious harm from using vapes to quit, though more longer-term research was needed. Asthma and Lung UK said urgent action was needed to make vaping less attractive to children while preserving a legitimate role helping adult smokers to quit.
Hugh Pym reporting.
Jane, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. The energy regulator has just raised the price cap for energy bills by £60 a year on average on an average bill. Suppliers say at the moment the typical household pays £600 a year more than it did before Russia invaded Ukraine. That increase has contributed to unpaid bills and charges, which firms expect to total £7 billion by the end of the year. Meanwhile, there are still big profits. Neil Kenwood's here, the Ofgem Director General of Markets. Neil, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
What is the raise by, tell us?
So this is an increase today of just under 4%, so 3.6%. So that's about £5 per month on the average bill. And the main driver of that is the rise in international gas prices, which has restricted supplies out of the Straits of Hormuz. And that feeds directly into our gas bills, but also contributes to higher electricity bills because we still burn some gas for electricity.
So you see it as the only way and fair?
The only way and fair?
To do this. I mean, there'll be those listening thinking, well, I'm going to go and look up the profits, as I have this morning, yeah. And we have here on the team of these big businesses, and still see there are some. And many people are incredibly worried about the winter ahead.
Yeah, and I understand those worries, of course. What the price cap does is it ensures that the energy companies can recover the actual costs of supplying electricity and gas to our homes with a small profit margin, but no more than that. So it does protect consumers from higher energy prices.
And you think you've got it right, the level?
Yeah, we have some complicated calculations to try and figure out exactly what the cost of supplying electricity and gas to homes is, and that's what drives the price cap.
But this, just talk to me about that small profit margin. How small is small?
Yeah, it's just over 2.5% at the moment, and actually most years energy suppliers have not been making that level of profit because there's other pressures that they face. So it's that profit is essential for companies to be in the market, operate, and to invest in the products and services we need. It's worth saying that that's delivered some of the highest consumer satisfaction we've ever seen in the sector this year, over 80%.
But I doubt over breakfast this morning hearing what you've got to say will be delivering consumer satisfaction.
So I think that it is clearly challenging when energy bills are rising. And it's worth noting that energy bills would have risen further had it not been from the government's VAT cut on electricity.
So, but doesn't this wipe this out? What is the relationship with that? Because if the, as you say, government policy removing VAT from electricity bills, what will this do to that?
So gas bills are going up by, on average, about 8% in October, but electricity bills are actually falling slightly because of that VAT, but also because we're less dependent on the price of gas. It doesn't drive electricity in the same way. So we're now starting to see, for the second price cap in a row, a bit of a gap open up between gas bills and electricity bills. And that, in a sense, is positive because it means the transition, for example, to heat pumps becomes cheaper for households.
Do you ever see this? I mean, people talk about prices rising and they never come down. I mean, what do you see in terms of the trends here and the capacity for that at some point?
Yeah, and prices obviously did come down a lot after the Ukraine crisis. They've now risen again because, as I say, primarily the events in the Middle East. In the longer term, we're going to be reducing that dependence on gas further, particularly for electricity, and that offers the opportunity to get away from those high and volatile international gas prices.
So, I mean, Iran is and what's going on in the Middle East, that's the predominant driver this
absolutely
time.
Absolutely the key driver, and it was at the last price cap as well.
And because we don't know what's going to happen there, you can't make any predictions, of course, on this.
We can't. We wouldn't make predictions. The gas price is volatile, and sort of moving away from that is one of the benefits, I suppose, of decarbonisation.
And how long do we have this for, this cap?
This cap will run from October to December. So they run each for 3 months.
And in terms of what do you expect to happen as we are in Christmas time and going to January? I mean, what, any view on that at all? Just so people are trying to plan, is there going to be another hike?
Yeah, so the main driver of the whatever the price cap is in January will be, the main change will come from whatever's happening in with gas prices and in international gas prices. So it could be that, events resolve in the Gulf and flows of gas pick up and the price starts to come down. But equally, they could go higher. We can't rule that out.
Neil Kenwood, Ofgem's Director General of Markets. Thank you.
Thank you.
14 minutes past seven. Is electoral reform hoving back into view? Almost 100 Labour MPs are backing calls for a national commission to look at replacing first past the post with a more proportional voting system. Perhaps they're striking because Andy Burnham has long been a supporter of electoral reform, though his position now is that it should be a commitment for a future Labour manifesto. Mike Reader is the Labour MP for Northampton South, who's also signed the amendment calling for this national commission. He joins us now. Mr. Reader, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Why now?
Well, this week, well, in fact, next week, the Representation of the People Bill will be back in Parliament, and we think it's the right time now for the government to commit to a national commission to look at electoral reform. We're not asking for the change now, and Andy is right. Perhaps there is needed for a mandate through a manifesto for that change, but that doesn't stop us getting this commission now to look at this, to make sure that people feel like their vote counts and to make sure people don't feel disenfranchised by the political system.
Well, the arguments for first past the post, which you'll be familiar with, are that it forces parties to become coalitions, appeal to a broad base, and that also it allows us to have strong, effective governments with really workable majorities rather than the slightly messy coalitions you sometimes see in Europe. Why is that position wrong?
I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. We see very stable, successful governments under different forms of proportional representation in Europe and around the world. And likewise, we see very unstable governments around the world where there is a first-past-the-post system. What we see now is a much broader voter coalition who are looking for a voice. We see that with the rise of other parties beyond the Conservatives and Labour and the Liberal Democrats. And people want to feel like when they vote, they understand their vote is going to make a difference. And there are too many people in our country who are disenfranchised from the voting system and disenfranchised from elections. And we have different voting systems across the country already. The voting system for our general election is different to the Scottish elections, the Welsh elections, the elections for our local mayors, which the government has reverted back to proportional representation. We have different systems for our London Assembly and for our councillors. So the idea that the UK has one single voting system is not right. Yeah, and actually, this is what we need to look at, how do we get a system that people understand?
Hasn't this commission already happened? Aren't you a bit late to the party? And the commission once upon a time had a very erudite author too. If you go back to October 1998, I'm sure you've enjoyed reading Roy Jenkins' commission into a more proportional system. He recommended AV+. Why didn't you just dust that off?
Well, that commission was nearly 30 years ago. Times have substantially changed. I think your listeners will recognise that in the electoral, in the political world. And so 30 years later, we think it is right to have a look at this again.
And would you apply the same argument to the referendum that we had less time ago, merely a decade and a bit ago, where there was a referendum on electoral reform and it was soundly rejected?
There was a referendum over a decade ago on a very specific type of a very specific voting system, which quite frankly was run in a very bad way by the campaign for change, and people didn't understand it, and that was the fear. What we've got now is there is a mandate amongst Labour MPs, there is a mandate amongst MPs generally, and there is a mandate across the public for looking at this. The polling shows there is an overwhelming majority for some form of electoral reform, right through from Nigel Farage in Reform right through to Labour MPs like me.
And a final thought, is your personal position that if there were to be a change to the electoral system, it shouldn't just be something in a manifesto, but would need to be put to the people in a referendum?
No, not necessarily. I think if it's clear that there is a argument for change, there is public support for change, I wouldn't want the public to go through another referendum. We can't get to a position in this country that every big decision we divert away from the politicians we've elected to be in Parliament, and the public have to make that choice every time.
Okay. Mike Reader, Labour MP for Northampton South, who's signed that amendment. Thank you very much indeed.
18 minutes past seven. A new review has examined 80 studies involving almost 30,000 people and found that vapes are a proven and viable option for people wishing to quit traditional cigarettes, more so than nicotine gum and patches. Well, how does that sit with you? Perhaps you've been on this road. Matt has. He gave up smoking cigarettes for vaping around 11 years ago when his wife got pregnant and has been vaping ever since. Matt will be talking to you in just a moment, but we're also going to be hearing from Dr. Nicola Linson, lead author of The Review and Associate Professor at the Nuffield Department of Primary Care Health Sciences at the University of Oxford. But Matt, first to you. You gave up and the vapes have worked?
Hi, good morning, Emma.
Morning.
Yes, they have, yeah. They were far more effective than other means that I tried.
And in terms of that concern that some have around vaping, this report out today, I mean, what do you make of that when you started down that road?
Well, I mean, I think everybody that vapes wonders a little whether further research will come out that suggests it's not terribly good for you, but The understanding is that it's certainly far better for you than smoking is. And so it's a step in the right direction towards, you know, giving up nicotine addiction entirely.
Does it feel different vaping in your body than smoking? What would you say it feels like in terms of those who might be thinking of doing this?
It does. It's not doing exactly the same thing. But I think one of the reasons it worked for me is that it replaces not only the nicotine, but it also replaces some of the habit that you're still doing the same hand action. You've still got the same habits formed, and it does feel different in your body. My lungs feel considerably better for not smoking.
Do you think vaping is as addictive though as cigarettes?
I don't think I can only talk from my personal experience here, but
yes.
Trying to give up smoking was enormously difficult. I tried several times, whereas when my wife gave up vaping, I stopped for a while and I didn't find that anywhere near as difficult. Okay. I have then gone back to vaping, but that was a personal choice rather than feeling that I had to because of the addiction.
Let me bring in Dr. Linson at this point. What can we take from the news today then?
Hi, Emma.
Hello.
So basically what we found is that through these 80 studies, in culmination, they're showing us that e-cigarettes or nicotine vapes do help more people to stop smoking than nicotine replacement therapy. So things like patches and gum. And that equates to if around 6 out of 100 people quit smoking with nicotine replacement therapy, then around 10 out of 100 would quit with nicotine vapes. And obviously those numbers don't sound massive, but as Matt said, quitting smoking is uniquely difficult. And so unfortunately what we do see is that most people who make quit attempt won't be successful on that quit attempt, and it takes many, many times to try and quit.
And so in terms of the long-term health impacts of vaping, what can we say about that if we're now saying this is the way to do it versus the patches and the gums?
Yeah, so we looked at that in the review as well. We didn't find any evidence of an increase in severe health impacts of vaping, but we should say that we would like more information from studies to be more certain of that. So at the minute, there's no clear indication that the vapes themselves are causing any kind of severe ill effects.
And so what would be a good result from this, if you see what I mean, in terms of real world consequences and our health?
Well, what we'd say in general is that if people don't smoke, then don't vape, because although we don't think that vaping causes serious harms in people who already smoke, there is likely to be some potential health effects for people who have never smoked. However, obviously, smoking is incredibly bad for you, and we know that vapes aren't as bad for you as smoking. So if someone smokes, then they are likely to significantly improve their health by quitting using a vape.
Do you smoke?
No, I don't smoke.
Okay, I always think it's quite interesting if you're on looking at this and if you actually do it and you've tried to quit. Matt, you're my person for that this morning because you've been on this and you're doing it at the moment. What do you make of listening to that? Are you reassured?
Well, yes, I am. Yeah, it will make sense to me. I think what the report shows is matches up with my lived experience as well. And but anything that tells me that vaping is better for me than smoking was is good news.
Well, it's definitely what you want to read while you're still vaping, isn't it? Do you think you'll ever give it up?
Yes, I do. I do.
Well, you had a good reason to change in the first place, as I understand, when your wife became pregnant. But what do you think it'll be? Have you got any idea what that prompt might be?
I think that's the key thing here is that I think the vaping provided the means to stop smoking, and the motivation was certainly my son being on the way. I think it would be helpful to understand as a next step what's the plan for helping people to get off vaping. And maybe there's a bit more work that could be done there. Personally, I think that doesn't need as strong a push for me. I think it just needs a kick up the backside.
Well, there you go. Someone will give it to you or not, but we'll see. Matt, thanks very much for being on the programme this morning. And thank you to Dr. Nicola Linson too.
25 minutes past seven, well, the tributes are pouring in this morning to Dolly Parton. So Sir Elton John, who performed with Dolly in 2005, said he was shocked and devastated by the news. A giant of an artist, unique and irreplaceable, with the kindest heart, he said. Taylor Swift, who began her professional career in country music as a teenager after moving to Nashville, has paid tribute to Parton's true grace and true grit, all in one dazzling person. A world without Dolly doesn't feel possible, real or right, the singer said in a statement shared with the BBC. But because of the eternally generous way she spent her time on this earth and the countless lives she changed for the better, her legacy will be an everlasting one. New York City's Empire State Building has been lit up in pink in memory of the legendary singer. Fans have been gathering at her star on the Hollywood Boulevard too.
This was it's a devastating loss. Dolly Parton truly is an important person, and will forever be in our hearts, definitely.
Dolly was everything to me. Everybody was calling me when she passed away, my sisters and my best friend. She was like an angel of earth. She was too good for this world. She taught me how to just be myself, how to just have fun and don't care what people think.
Indeed. You know, so many of her lines we're thinking of this morning. I do still love the line when asked how long her hair took to do. She used to say, well, I'm never there when they're doing it. It's just such a good one. But more to come. And we'll be speaking to Jo Wiley a bit later on in the programme when she interviewed her after that legendary and highly anticipated and much loved Glastonbury set when Dolly Parton came to those fields. Mike, you love those fields. I love those fields. But we're not talking about Glastonbury now.
No, when I was there, though, in 2014.
Did you go to that one?
I was there. Okay. And it was the highlight, not just of that Glastonbury weekend, but possibly of my entirety
jealous.
Of going to that famous festival.
I hope you wore rhinestones. Do carry on.
not quite, but it was an afternoon to remember. We are going to start the sport this morning in Austria and talk about one of the biggest collapses in the history of Celtic Football Club.
And the referee blows the final whistle and Celtic are out of the Champions League. They have blown a 4-goal lead in the tie. Somehow they have shipped 5 goals. They cannot believe what has happened to them. It is an infamous night in Celtic's European history.
Yes, for all the wrong reasons. Celtic went into the second leg of their Champions League playoff tie with the Austrian side LASK last night, 3-0 up from the first leg. Martin O'Neill's side then opened the scoring to lead the tie 4-0 overall, only to collapse and lose the match 5-4 on aggregate in extra time.
We have obviously a lot of work to do. You can cover over cracks at certain stages, you know, but overall, these games are real, real tests for you. And unfortunately, we failed that test tonight.
Well, Celtic will now drop into the Europa League, the draw for which will take place on Friday. We now, though, are going to talk golf briefly because the Masters champion Rory McIlroy says new plans from the PGA Tour to introduce end-of-season playoffs will provide a more exciting finish to the golfing season. The new structure will begin in 2028. Let's bring in golf correspondent Ian Carter. Morning, Ian.
Good morning, Mike.
So just tell us, what are the PGA proposing?
Well, this is going to be the climax to a new format where you're going to have the world's best players playing in the Championship Series, those a little bit below them playing in the Challengers Series, promotion and relegation from those. But from that Championship Series, it's all going to whittle down to what is effectively a football-style World Cup of golf for the players individually. The first week will be on one course somewhere in America, where eight groups of four will play each other. They're the leading players from the stroke play portion of the season. They're going to play round robin group matches, as you do in the Football World Cup. The following week, at a different course, the top two from each of those groups, so 16 players, they'll then play head-to-head knockout matches, building to a final to eventually crown the season-long winner, the one individual who survived it all.
All right, and that change being implemented, as we say, the year after next. How does this feed, Ian, into this ongoing schism in world golf, though, the much documented conflict with LIV Golf? This presumably strengthens the hand of the PGA and DP World Tours.
Yes, it does. And from the DP World Tour's point of view, they're able to capitalize on the American season finishing in August. It finishes in August because they don't want the golf in America to clash with the NFL season. There's just too much competition for eyeballs. That's the feeling. So that opens up the next 5 months of the year to go around the world. And it being 5 months, the leading players are not going to want to be not playing for that period. So the feeling is the American stars will then start to go global. And of course, the European Tour always makes out to be the tour that is truly global. And this is going to be an attractive proposition to the players. There's no doubt about that. And that piles pressure onto LIV because they are trying to secure the investment to keep them going after Saudi Arabia pulled out of their backing for the LIV Tour. So big changes, and you can see the established tours really applying the pressure now on LIV.
All right, Ian Carter, many thanks for that this morning. Golf correspondent Ian there speaking to us from the Belfry, which hosts the British Masters starting tomorrow. And on that, the golf chat continues in the next hour. We shall speak to the host of this year's British Masters, Sir Nick Faldo, will join us on the programme.
Lovely stuff. Thank you. Michael Burke now joining us in the studio with details of this evening's Moral Mate. Hello, Michael.
Morning, Emma. If you want to see the future, go to Slough. It's home to Europe's largest AI data centre hub. Don't worry, there could soon be a centre near you. There's 100 on the stocks in the UK alone, some using as much energy as a town and taking millions of litres of water to keep cool. This, they say, is technology's greatest leap forward, promising us prosperity and security. For others, the price is already too high, with some having to make sacrifices now so the tech giants can build their scary new world. What price the AI future? The Moral Maze, after the news at 8 tonight.
Michael, thank you very much indeed. Well, in 1996, Ken Clark described Gordon Brown as belonging to the Dolly Parton School of Economics. And the former Prime Minister is joining us in a couple of minutes, though, to talk about populist politics rather than popular music. That's coming up very shortly indeed.
But we'll get back to the music of Dolly Parton very soon as well indeed. It's 28 minutes to 8. You are listening to Today. Good to have you with us on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Energy prices for millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales at a rise to their highest level in 3 years after the regulator Ofgem confirmed the energy price cap would increase. It means the annual bill for a typical household that is not on a fixed tariff will rise by £60 a year. Ofgem's Director General of Markets, Neil Kenwood, told us the conflict in the Gulf remains the biggest cause of rising prices. Flags across the United States are flying at half-mast following the death of Dolly Parton. The country music legend died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist said was a brief battle with cancer. There have been tributes from across the music industry. Sir Paul McCartney said Dolly Parton was magnificent and unrivalled, while Taylor Swift said a world without her didn't feel possible, real or right.
At least 14 babies have died in a fire that broke out in a hospital in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Local media said the fire started on the maternity ward in the building after an air conditioning unit exploded. The Pakistani Prime Minister, Shehbaz Sharif, called it a tragic incident and ordered an investigation. Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems after being sexually abused as children. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has apologised for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis. It's estimated around 9% of adults were sexually abused during their childhood. The boss of Instagram, Adam Mosseri, has been giving evidence in the high-profile trial of the tech giant Meta in California. 29 US states claim that the firm, which owns Facebook and Instagram, designed its products to be addictive to children and then hid research from the public. Meta has consistently denied the allegations. An inquest will be opened in London today into the death of Professor Jason Arday. The 44-year-old was found dead at his home earlier this month, less than 2 weeks after resigning from the University of Cambridge over allegations of plagiarism.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 26 minutes to 8. At the turn of the century, a Harvard professor turned an academic paper on the decline of American community life into a seminal book that made him a global celebrity. Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone argued that civic and associational life in America was in hasty retreat. Membership of local and neighborhood organizations, from voluntary groups to friendly societies, women's groups, mothers' institutes, and the like, were receding. Sports clubs had diminished, hence the book's title. Meanwhile, trade union membership had fallen, and congregations of faith were getting smaller too. All the little platoons of Burkean folklore were getting, well, littler. Putnam said that the rise of two technologies, the car and the television, had accelerated this decline. And since then, we've had the internet, social media, and the smartphone. A new book argues that in the UK, all the trends that Putnam outlined a quarter of a century ago have hugely accelerated. And it posits a direct causal connection between people with low levels of what Putnam called bridging capital, connections with people unlike you, and their inclination to vote for the populist right. Loners vote for authoritarians, therefore global disorder and local decline are bonded. Rebuilding our civic life, the book argues, must become the central mission of our time. The author of that book, which is out on September the 1st, is the former Prime Minister and Chancellor Gordon Brown, who joins us now. Mr. Brown, good morning.
Good morning.
This book contains some fresh research, lots of fresh research on modern Britain, particularly the decline of associational life. Let's start there. What have you found?
Well, there's some great community organisations and some wonderful community champions. But the truth is that 50% of the adult population of the United Kingdom are not involved in any civic group, any community action of any kind, whether it's a church or whether it's a faith group or whether it's a trade union or whether it's a sports club or cultural group. And 40% of people tell us when we've done these polls, and this is true, by the way, right across the West, not just across Britain, 40% say that if they were in difficulty, apart from their immediate family, there's nobody else they feel they could turn to. 67% say that they've got three friends or less, and 12% say they've got no friends. So we're witnessing something quite really epochal. If the physical infrastructure, like the roads and the railways, broke down, there'd be immediate calls for action. If the financial infrastructure, our banks and ATMs, broke down, there'd be panic. But we've got this breakdown in our civic society, and we really have to turn our attention to doing something about that. Because what we also find is that those people who are not involved in the community, don't have connections across religious and ethnic grounds, are the least likely to support international cooperation across borders. These are the people who are least likely and most likely, of course, to vote for populist nationalist parties, which are leading the polls in most parts of Europe at the moment.
So you posit a direct and causal connection between people with low levels of social capital, what Putnam called bridging capital, meeting and knowing people unlike yourself, and this affinity, this tendency to vote for the populist right.
It's not as direct as that, right. If I may say so, John. What happens is that a vacuum is created, there's a void, community organisations break down, and of course these populist nationalist politicians, Le Pen in France, the German AfD, they fill the vacuum. They walk in and they say, we represent you. We'll speak for you. Nobody else is speaking for you. There's nobody else on your side. And that's what's got to be addressed, that the breakdown of civic organizations in our country. What we've now got to do is do something about encouraging people to be active in their community, to be leaders in their community, exchanges of young people across communities, better civic spaces, and of course, rebuilding the public square so that people feel, as they don't feel at the moment, that they've got a role to play in making the decisions that affect their lives.
But you'll know that many populists listening to you would say the following, and I want to put it to you quite directly. They'd say one of the reasons we've got weak connections between people is because we have so many new people. Mass immigration, on the scale this country, for instance, has never seen, has transformed many communities, and it's just common sense to say there's a trade-off between diversity and the kind of solidarity or civic participation you want to see. What do you say to that?
Yes, you've got to manage migration properly. I mean, what we find is, yes, there's superficial symptoms of people's dissatisfaction, is a loss of trust in authority, a nostalgia for the past, a sense that that people are not integrating into their society and therefore less tolerance. But underneath it, what is directly affecting people's lives is a sense of financial disappointment, but also the loss of civic support, that they don't feel there's anybody on their side. And we've got to address the fundamental causes, which I think is that people feel that civic society is not what it used to be, has got to be rebuilt. And I think if we did that, then we'd also find people more supportive of what is another theme of my book, of doing something about the breakdown of the world order, which we're seeing in front of our eyes in Ukraine and Iran and everywhere else. And there's a direct connection, of course. If people are not involved in their own communities, they don't seem to want to support international cooperation either.
We'll come back to the book because it does end in a hopeful way, which I want to return to. But you mentioned the loss of or the lack of financial support that people feel. And we're speaking just a few minutes after the latest energy price cap. I want to ask you about that directly. Do you feel the government has done enough to soften the impact of higher energy prices, which, let's be frank, are often out of their control?
Look, I know Andy Burnham, and I know one of his first acts was to reduce VAT on fuel. I know he, like me, will be determined to do something about this very big rise in fuel bills that's going to take place during the winter months. And it's coming on top of what is going to be big rises in fuel bills, as far as I can see from conditions around the world. So our fiscal rules should never be so inflexible that we can't do things that are urgent, necessary and fair within our fiscal rules. And so I would support, for example, betting and gaming, machine gaming tax, up to 500 million can be raised without affecting bingo halls or affecting pubs. But these adult entertainment centres, I would put a tax on that, and I would use that money to pay for help in the Crisis and Resilience Fund for people who are facing difficulties with the fuel bills. Now, there's long-term changes that have got to be made. We've got to look at a social tariff. I don't see why the energy price that people pay should be so dependent on the international gas market. There are these changes that can be made. But in the immediate future, I think Andy Burnham, I know him well, will want to do something along the lines I'm suggesting.
You know him well. You also know John Healey very well, who's coming up with his first budget on October the 28th. It's very interesting to me, Mr. Brown, you mentioned the fiscal rules there. You obviously championed fiscal rules in a very, very different context 30-odd years ago. But are you arguing that the current fiscal rules potentially limit the government's ability to help voters?
No, I'm suggesting this machine gaming tax within the fiscal rules. Right. That's a transfer from a bad, if you like, to a good, which is helping people who've got to choose between heating, eating and keeping clean. We do not want this winter to see families faced with these terrible choices. I'm involved in a charity, Warm Welcome. We've got 5,000 spaces around the country for pensioners, others who feel that they cannot afford to heat their homes during the day and can come to this community centre. So we've got to do something about that. The fiscal rules are flexible enough, in my view, to allow us to do more in defence as well. So John Healey is committed to doing that. And I've made proposals to him as a result of a request that was made by Keir Starmer for a new defence finance mechanism, which would be a European-wide mechanism, which would be in charge of joint procurement of defence products, coordinated research and development, a stockholding facility. And that can all be done within our fiscal rules to allay the pressure on the defence budget at the moment.
And I know that Number 10 have confirmed you're going to continue acting informally, I think, as an advisor to Mr. Burnham ahead of the UK leadership of the G20. The book
that you've written, which is called, I should say, The Future Begins With Us. Sorry, The Future Starts With Us, is dedicated to the people of Kikodi. I do want to end there in a moment. Before I do that, the last time you and I spoke on this programme, it was about your concerns about the institutional response in this country to the revelations about Jeffrey Epstein's depravity. And I know you've spent a lot of time looking through the Epstein's files. Are you satisfied with the response this country's institutions are now conducting on that whole issue?
Well, since I talked to you and others about this, I've been approached by a number of women who have been abused or who are, know people who have been abused by Jeffrey Epstein and people associated with him. I believe that the police will continue their inquiries. I'm trying to help them with that. And I think the sooner that they are able to interview people who've been directly affected and who has been enabling this and who has been benefiting from this abuse of women, the better. I think the police owe it to the people who have been abused, who've not had justice, to take this as seriously as possible. And that affects many constabularies around the country where girls and women were being trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein for the evil purposes that he was engaged in. So more has got to be done. Yes.
Okay. The book, The Future Starts With Us, is dedicated to the people of Kikodi and Fife. And in the acknowledgements you write, hope is at the centre of this book. 50-odd years after you first started getting involved in politics, is your local community, your social capital, still your biggest source of hope?
Yes, and what's fascinating about Kikodi, my town, is that 50,000 people are signed up to a Facebook site where information is exchanged, people meet people as a result of it, community groups are being formed. And yes, social media can be a huge problem, but if you link that to participatory activities and building community groups where people meet face-to-face, then you can do something about this breakdown in community, which is really a big feature of life, not just in Britain, but right across the Western world. I do say it is related also to the breakup of the world order. And I think we've got to turn our attention also to how, instead of politicians forgetting the lessons of World Wars One and Two, people remember that cooperation is the basis on which we've got to move forward to solve not just the problems of peace and war, but climate, AI regulation, and many other issues of poverty and disease that affect so many people around the world. Cooperation has got to be the basis. And it's because I think people are in the end hopeful that we can get together that my book ends in that optimistic note.
Gordon Brown, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's 7:45. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll be hearing more about Dolly Parton's life, legacy, her talent, her impact. I'll be speaking to the Radio 2 DJ and Glastonbury host Joe Wiley, who did interview her just after and around that amazing set at Glastonbury. But first now, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, Superintendent Minister of Wellesley's Chapel and Leyden Mission. Excuse me.
Good morning, Emma. What makes a good home? Surely safety, fresh, cool air, heating that works, the means to make food and be clean, to choose a color for the wall or welcome a guest and put on music. It's news to no one that good housing is one foundation of a community in which neighbors not only notice when someone is ill, but knock on their door to check. This week, we hear about national investment in new social and affordable homes, much needed, but also of young people turning 18 and aging out of care overnight, deprived of personal support with devastating effect, even if given the keys to a flat. Clearly, a good home is more than an empty room with a lock on the door. Acts 2 spoke of the early Christians sharing bread and possessions and opening their homes to one another. Household was not just for private safety, but neighborly welcome. From their founding, the goal of organizations like the Methodist Leesian Mission, among many others, was never to have autonomous households behind locked doors. Their goal was neighbors living well alongside one another, helping one another with the support of the church. Without for a second romanticizing the past, the hope was that someone on their own would have a place to go and a table to eat at and something to do that was needed. Isolation was as acute and more then as now, but building community still takes more than social housing, however important. I think of a church member in the council flat she has finally moved into with her teenage son. Her pride shows when you walk in. For close to 7 years, that mum and son lived in a succession of bedsits in shared accommodation, officially homeless. They did their best to make a home in those rooms too, not least through the church, giving much more help and support to others than they ever received. But I know how many school nights the son stayed with church members or waited for his mom to finish work because she couldn't know day to day who else would be living in the house where they slept. Last week, her son got a strong set of GCSEs. He will go on to A-levels. I give thanks for his mum and all the teachers and friends who've stood by him and others like him. And our work is clearly not done while one other slips through the cracks of our collective good intention. We all need good homes. What makes one? What always has? Love, safety, neighbours, purpose, and hope.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, Superintendent Minister of Wesley's Chapel and Leesian Mission.
It's 12 minutes to 8. A rare unifying figure across America, where flags are flying half-mast across the country to mark the death of the country music legend, songwriter, actor, theme park owner and philanthropist, Dolly Parton. From Donald Trump to Barack Obama, Oprah Winfrey to Mick Jagger, Jane Fonda to Bette Midler. I could keep going. The tributes are flowing and fulsome for a woman who once said, "I'm not offended by the dumb blonde jokes because I know I'm not dumb and I'm not blonde either." She also said, "People ask me how long it takes to do my hair. I don't know. I'm never there," came the response. Dolly Parton died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. Well, let's have a listen and a think about some of the ways we've got to know her over the years. In 2024, our guest editor here on the Today programme, Frank Cottrell Boyce, then the Children's Laureate, had one big request. We often get them from our guest editors. We brought him together, though, with Dolly Parton. It doesn't get bigger than that. We heard earlier in the programme about Dolly's work on her Imagination Library charity that gives out free books to children, but she also told him about a book she'd written of her own.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Dolly. It's amazing to be talking to you. Yeah, I don't know where to start. So it's really wonderful to be talking to you. So for listeners who don't know, Dolly's written a book called Billy the Kid's Home for Christmas. And Billy the Kid is a very successful French bulldog, but also country singer. And in this book, he's got quite a tough choice to make.
And actually, Billy the Kid was going to be with me today, but he had to go home for Christmas. No. But our first book was called Billy the Kid Makes It Big. And that's when he comes to Nashville trying to make it as a country star, and he does. And that one had the message of having confidence. I always try to create all the books that we're going to be doing with Billy the Kid with messages that children need to know, whether it be about confidence or bullying, loyalty, family, all of that. So in this book, Billy's made it big, so he's now on tour in his bus with his band.
Dolly Parton never spoke about her political affiliations, but she put her money where her mouth was for causes she believed in. In March 2021, Dolly did a special rewrite of her song Jolene, you may remember this, in an attempt to encourage people to get the Moderna COVID jab, which incredibly, she helped to finance to the tune of $1 million.
Well, hey, it's me. I'm finally going to get my vaccine. I'm so excited. I've been waiting a while. I'm old enough to get it, and I'm smart enough to get it. So I'm very happy that I'm going to get my Moderna shot today. And I wanted to tell everybody, I think you should get out there and do it too. I even changed one of my songs to fit the occasion. It goes, vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate.
She was literally taking her own medicine because of that funding. Incredible. In 2023, Dolly Parton was asked by our colleagues on BBC Breakfast if she saw herself as a feminist.
No, I'm feminine. I see myself as a female. But I do agree that whether you're a man or a woman, black, white, green, purple or alien grey, you should be allowed to be paid and treated with respect in what you're capable of doing. Because I always like to be a good example. I don't feel I have to march in the streets to say I'm a woman or I have this and that. But I've been writing those kind of songs to uplift women ever since I've been in the career. My first number one song was a song called Just Because I'm a Woman. My mistakes are no worse than yours, just because I'm a woman. So I just try to live it and be it.
Indeed. And one of the most well-remembered appearances that Dolly Parton made was at the Glastonbury Festival. It was long awaited. It was 2014. She played that coveted legend slot. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be looking that up again today, and secured a whole new generation of fans. Well, the Radio 2 DJ, Glastonbury host, of course, Joe Wiley, interviewed her directly after that set.
Your favourite bit of the set, what did you particularly enjoy? Is there a moment?
Oh, I just loved it all. I just loved the excitement and the electricity of them being out there just taking part in every song. Like, and the singing along with me, that was a big thrill. Singing 9 to 5 with those voices, that was probably the biggest thrill of the night.
I know, you could absolutely see that. What's the strangest sight that you've seen? Because there were many people dressed up as you.
Yeah, I know. Well, I see that everywhere. There's a lot of drag queens out there. I always said it's a good thing I was a girl, because I would have definitely been a drag queen.
Joe Wiley joins us now. It's lovely to have you on the line, Joe. And I understand you were actually going on air last night on Radio 2 when the news was breaking.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I was. The news, I think we were 90 seconds away from being live on Radio 2, and we normally do the Shiny Happy playlist, and then the news was announced. And we were like, OK, let's just throw everything out of the window. And instinctively, we just played Dolly from 7 o'clock onwards on Radio 2, and we had all tributes from people about what she meant to them. We played I Will Always Love You as the very first song of the show, and we were all in tears. It was unbelievably sad and very moving.
I mean, that connection people have to her, it's this link to truth and pain and, you know, she didn't shy away from the difficult things of life, did she? I mean, I was reading this morning just this wonderful line from a writer and professor, Helen Morales, who wrote about her. And she said she had this insistent witnessing, particularly of women's lives.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I haven't heard anybody say a bad word about her. This grieving for Dolly is just universal. She showed people that no matter what your background was, where you came from, you could make it if you had talent and you had you put in the hard work. She inspired lots of women to pick up an instrument, to write songs, to find their voice and to be their own boss, which was incredibly important right from the very beginning. She was just extraordinary. She was superhuman. I think Jack White posted something and just said instant saint, and that's what she felt like she was a living saint, which is why we're all bereft, I think, of the thought of a world without Dolly, because it's inconceivable. She's always been there. She's always shone really brightly, whether it's the strength, the spirituality, the showbiz, the flair, everything. She meant everything to everybody.
The range of tributes is extraordinary. I mean, I don't know why I was served this first this morning, but when I woke up and opened, I think it was Instagram, I saw that a letter she'd sent that had been posted by Eminem.
Eminem, I know.
I mean, I just thought, why? She was writing to Eminem. And, you know, yeah. She said she didn't know much about rap and she didn't know much about that world, but he was so good at it.
I saw that as well. Like, I was like, what an extraordinary thing to have done. And then I was so sad because he said at the end of it that they never did meet. She was saying that she always felt some kind of, he was a kindred spirit and that they never did meet.
But you did meet her. What was she like in person? What was that experience like?
Oh, she was just so generous and so kind. I read her talking about Glastonbury, and she said that she was really hesitant about doing it because they were going to be rock people that were there and they might be drinking and doing other stuff and not interested in her stories and her music. And then she said at the end it turned out to be one of the greatest things that I've ever done, and she'd never seen so many people looking out from the stage for miles and miles. And she was really generous in the interview. It was about 2 minutes long, and at the end I said, could we do a photograph? And she was like, absolutely we could. And her people were trying to whisk her away, and she was like, no, we're doing this photograph. And I was like, gosh, you didn't have to do that, but that summed up what she was like.
You know, you mentioned there I Will Always Love You. I mean, just such an incredible song. But the story, I was also reminded in some of the obituaries this morning that Elvis Presley had wanted it. He'd wanted to sing it, and she would have had to sign away 50% of the royalties. So she held out and didn't give this song to Elvis Presley. And obviously many years later, it went to Whitney Houston, which apparently meant she netted $10 million alone and just to her, not to 50% to the Elvis Presley estate.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and that says it all, doesn't it? That how smart and this business mind that she had, that was completely shrouded by the showbiz, by the glamour. Through the 70s, everyone just kind of had this stereotypical image of what Dolly was all about. But she, underneath it all, she knew exactly what she was doing. She was playing the long game, and she won in the end. She won our hearts and she won the respect of absolutely everybody. And she was probably one of the greatest songwriters of all time.
I mean, she herself suffered enormously. She didn't talk much about it in detail, but she had endometriosis. She was in a lot of pain. She underwent some very severe surgery as well. And she was married to the guy she met the first day she went into town, I believe, when she was just 18 in Nashville, and he died last year. So she never became a mother. She spoke about her love of children, and she did a great deal for children. And she seemed to have this motherly almost approach to a lot of the stars coming through.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. She, kind of in that Elton John way of looking after people and wanting to promote their careers and take care of people's mental health. She was just, like I said before, like this saintly figure who understood the pain and the grief that goes on in all of us, for everybody. But throughout that, you could still rise above it. And that was why she was so special.
Well, it feels special to be remembering her with you on the programme this morning. Is there a song that you'll always hold up as your personal favourite from the Dolly vast collection?
I Will Always Love You, possibly. I got in my car last night. I played it twice in my show last night, at the very beginning and the very end. And then I got in the car on the way home and another DJ was playing it, and I just sat and sobbed my heart out to it because it's such a special song, the sentiment of it and the way she sings it. I mean, Whitney, might have been number one for decades, but Dolly, it was her song and she sang it best.
Joe Wiley, remembering Dolly Parton. Thank you, Joe.
2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather with Thomas Schaffernicker.
Amol, thank you very much. Well, some of us will need our brollies today. The showers are brewing at the moment. There's plenty of them across the Midlands, across parts of Wales too, and just nudging into the northwest of England. And a couple of really heavy showers across Essex too. So they're sort of scattered quite randomly across the country, but more of us will get them later on. However, some areas will stay completely dry. It is bone dry in the very far south of the country, and that's how it's going to stay really through today. So anywhere from Cornwall, Devon, through the southern counties, I think a mostly sunny afternoon and plenty of sunshine from East Anglia, the east coast of England, all the way from Norwich, all the way up to the northeast of Scotland. I think sunny skies for you here today as well. Quite warm temperatures, up to 25 or 6 Celsius in London and the southeast. Manchester should get 23, and we'll be hovering around 20 or so in Belfast and also in the lowlands of Scotland. Now, this evening and overnight, there'll be a bit of a break from the showers, and then they will return. In fact, through the early hours of Thursday morning, the rain could be quite heavy in the south of the country. And then through tomorrow morning and into the afternoon, many of us across England and Wales will catch some decent rain. There could be some storms, some rumbles of thunder with hail and gusty winds too.
Thomas, thank you very much indeed, sort of. It's time to say you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. If you're just joining us or if you're still with us, I can tell you it's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 26th of August. The headlines. Energy bills are to hit their highest level in 3 years from October. That's under the latest price cap announced by the regulator Ofgem in the past hour. Music stars and fans and celebrities and presidents past and present are, describing their sheer love for the Queen of Country, Dolly Parton. And we've just been hearing a fantastic tribute there from our colleague Joe Wiley, who interviewed her after that iconic Glastonbury set, Dolly Parton, who died at the age of 80 yesterday. And in the next hour on that front, we'll be bringing you one of Britain's biggest country music bands, The Shires. Some of you, I'm sure, will know them. They say their work has been hugely influenced by Dolly, who above all was a songwriter. And we'll also be bringing you up to date with the rest of the day's news, including the fact that 14 babies have died after a fire at a maternity unit at a hospital in Pakistan.
Also coming up in the next hour, Emma speaks to the father of a civil servant in the Treasury who killed herself after being called in for an erroneous disciplinary hearing.
It's just devastating. It hasn't torn us apart, but it's torn such a big hole in our lives for what can only, in our mind, it's still perceived as possibly office gossip.
The novelist Robert Harris will explain why he's returned to ancient Rome for the first time in over a decade with his new book. And Dame Prulith speaks to us about her campaign to put an end to school lunchboxes, though a switch to cooked meals at school is not without its critics.
Pizza, pasta, pizza, pasta, pizza, pizza, pasta. And I get quite bored of that every day.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales will see their energy bills hit a three-year high from October as the impact of war in the Gulf drives up costs. The latest price cap set by the regulator Ofgem will add £60 a year to a typical bill. Our correspondent Coletta Smith reports.
The regulator is letting energy companies increase their prices this autumn for anyone who's not on a fixed tariff. The rise is due to the conflict in the Middle East pushing up global gas prices, and because keeping things cool through the hot summer across Europe has used much more gas supplies than usual for this point of the year. Most of the increase is on the unit price for gas, so homes which just use electricity will see a much smaller rise. The government says it's tackling the cost of energy by removing VAT on electricity from October. That will lower bills by around £45, but it isn't high enough to cover this £60 increase for the majority of customers. For many households, this price rise comes on top of existing energy debt, with suppliers saying energy bill arrears have now hit £6 billion.
Speaking on this programme in the past hour, Ofgem's Director General of Markets, Neil Kenwood, said the UK remained vulnerable to events in the Middle East.
This is an increase today of just under 4%, so 3.6%. And the main driver of that is the rise in international gas prices, which has restricted supplies out of the Straits of Hormuz. And that feeds directly into our gas bills, but also contributes to higher electricity bills because we still burn some gas for electricity.
American flags are flying at half-mast across the US to mark the death of the country music legend Dolly Parton. She died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. Many of the world's biggest music stars have joined famous fans in paying glowing tributes to the singer, who is best known for hits including 9 to 5, I Will Always Love You and Jolene. Sir Paul McCartney said she was magnificent and unrivalled, while Beyoncé called her the North Star, bold and brilliant, talented and tenacious. The former US President Barack Obama said it was hard to imagine many people having a bigger impact than Dolly Parton. Our North America correspondent Shaima Khalil reports from Los Angeles.
From the moment her death was announced, fans have gathered at Dolly Parton's star on Hollywood Boulevard. Some laid flowers. Others brought farewell messages. Many were visibly emotional. For them, this felt less like the death of a distant celebrity and more like losing someone whose voice was a soundtrack to their lives.
It's really, really terrible. It's really bad. And I don't feel good at all, so.
I was stunned. I was at my desk working and I had to take a break and stop because I was so overwhelmed with emotion.
She was really full of joy. She really was. Great entertainer. She was funny. She was an awesome lady.
Dolly Parton's music traveled across generations and her talent crossed genres. Some grew up with Jolene and Coat of Many Colors. Others discovered her through Whitney Houston's recording of I'll Always Love You or the film 9 to 5, which produced a Grammy Award-winning song of the same name. The rhinestones, the wigs, and the glamour made her instantly recognizable. But behind that larger-than-life image was an artist who connected with people on a much deeper level. Her generosity reached far beyond music. The Imagination Library, inspired by her father, who never learned to read, gave free books to millions of children around the world. In a deeply divided America, Dolly Parton was that rare unifying figure. She'll be remembered for the songs, the stories, and the philanthropy. But perhaps most of all, for being so completely and unapologetically herself.
14 babies have died in a fire that broke out in a maternity ward of a hospital in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Local media said the fire started after an air conditioning unit in the building exploded. Our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis, is at the scene.
Outside the hospital, there is a strong sense of shock. Police patrol the entrance. Fire engines are parked outside. Glass from shattered windows lies scattered on the pavement, mixed with medical masks. We saw families who lost their babies crying by the side of the ward. One man told us his three-day-old baby had died. Another woman said that she was inside the hospital with her sister-in-law, who had given birth just days before when the fire started. They were in the nursery opposite the room where the fire began. She said it was around 6 a.m. when they heard a shout. Initially, they thought someone had died, but then they saw the smoke. They grabbed the baby, so small she's yet to have a name, and ran.
Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems after being sexually abused as children. The Royal College of Psychiatrists has apologised for what it says is decades of mismanagement and misdiagnosis. The organisation's former president, Dr. Lade Smith, told us there needed to be more consistency in care.
It's really clear that these people have complex trauma and they have difficulty developing trusting relationships, yet the services that we provide don't provide that continuity of care. They don't provide, to, you know, that allows the opportunity to develop trusting therapeutic relationships. Often we just provide discrete, short packages of care that just aren't enough.
NHS England says specialist support is available to people who suffered sexual abuse and additional training is being provided to mental health teams in schools and colleges. A new analysis suggests smokers have a better chance of quitting if they use nicotine vapes rather than patches or gum. The Cochrane Review of the latest trials and research by a group of international experts also found the use of e-cigarettes was more successful than support programmes for smokers who want to give up. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
Health officials say adult smokers wanting to give up can be advised to switch to nicotine-based e-cigarettes. They say the health harms from tobacco smoking are considerably worse than from vaping. The new review, which looks at the use of licensed e-cigarettes, underlines that. The authors concluded that 6 in 100 smokers gave up after using nicotine replacement therapies, such as gums and patches, but of those who vaped, 10 in 100 quit the tobacco habit. And they said while vaping was not risk-free, there was no evidence of increased serious harm from using vapes to quit, though more longer-term research was needed. Asthma and Lung UK said urgent action was needed to make vaping less attractive to children while preserving a legitimate role helping adult smokers to quit.
A major new study led by researchers in Exeter is aiming to improve the understanding of heavy menstrual bleeding. The scientists are hoping the creation of what's expected to become the world's largest biobank of menstrual fluid samples could lead to the earlier diagnosis and better treatment of conditions including endometriosis and fibroids. Here's our health correspondent Matthew Hill.
Heavy menstrual bleeding affects millions of women, but researchers say it's still poorly understood. Scientists at the University of Bristol and Exeter are launching what they expect to be the world's largest collection of menstrual fluid samples, alongside detailed health data from volunteers. Participants will track their symptoms, sleep, mood and well-being through an app, while also providing samples using specially designed sanitary pads. The data will be linked to long-running health studies, including two called Children of the 90s and Born in Bradford. Researchers hope it will help identify biological markers linked to heavy periods, leading to faster diagnosis, more personalised treatments and better support for women in the future.
Seven lorries filled with tomatoes have arrived in the Spanish town of Buñol for what has become known as the world's biggest food fight. Visitors from around the world are expected at today's La Tomatina in the town square, where participants will pelt each other with the fruit for 1 hour. The town's deputy mayor says the tomatoes used are not for human consumption and are soft enough to avoid injuries when thrown.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 10 past eight. Poll after poll, survey after survey, focus group after focus group make abundantly clear that the cost of living is a top, if not the top concern of people across this country. There is nothing new here about the theory, at least, just plenty new about the reality, how bad this cost of living crisis is and how long it stayed bad. The poorer you are, the greater the proportion of your spending goes on food and energy. Higher energy prices feed into higher food prices. An hour ago, we got the new energy price cap from Ofgem. It will be 3.6%, an extra £60 a year on the average bill. As autumn and then winter approach now, what this means in practice for millions of people is a quotidian dilemma, heating or eating. In a few minutes, we'll speak to the Energy Secretary. And it's worth being clear that energy prices fluctuate largely, though not exclusively, due to factors beyond government control, like the Strait of Hormuz being shut for long periods. Andy Burnham has promised breathing space, which means making life more affordable. Let's work out what that means with two of our listeners before we turn to Miatta Fanpula. So first of all, it's Roger from the Wirral and Stacey from Braunston in Leicester. Roger and Stacey, good morning.
Good morning, I'm ill.
Thank you so
good
much.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Stacey. Roger, I'll tell you what, I'll just start with you if you don't mind. Roger, I hope you don't mind me saying, but just for our listeners' benefit so they understand, we'll save you having to say it, you're 83 and you still work, as I understand it. Where do you work, Roger?
I work at Lighthouse Lodge in New Brighton, a fantastic care home. I have to work, I have to say, Emil, because I'm on a government pension, is only half the minimum wage and I couldn't exist without working, so there you go.
Okay, so you work in a care home, that's highly skilled labour. Do you enjoy that job?
I love it because I'm the same age as the residents and we all get on together. Yeah, I work at activities and it's motivating people. And we've got some wonderful people out there. Unfortunately, a lot of them, you know, are incapacitated, which leads me to think, what am I going to do when I become incapacitated? Why this sort of thing worries me. It seems it's non-stop, everything's going up.
Well, you sound like a highly motivated and motivating bloke, if I may say, Roger, even though you're 83, you're still going strong. Do you get sick pay, Roger?
No. Well, you get government sick pay.
But you don't necessarily from this care home. Okay, no. We talk about the cost of living on programmes like this all the time. What do these higher energy bills, this morning's energy price gap, what does it actually mean for you, Roger?
Well, actually, at the moment, to me, as I'm working, it's not too bad. But what it means is, I worry, over 80s, I don't know whether you younger people know this, but we feel the cold terribly. And El Nino's coming, and it's supposed to be a dreadfully bad winter. What's that going to do to my energy bills?
So what do you do to heat the house?
I don't. I just have one. I have gas heater, and I have one heater in the room on at a time. I go to bed when it's cold at 7 o'clock, and I put the electric blanket on. Thank God for whoever the person was that invented the electric blanket. They should get a reward for that.
Have you got any debts, Roger? You got a mortgage?
Yeah, I've got a mortgage. I foolishly opted into a mortgage till I'm 99, so I'm still paying my mortgage. I still have debts. I have Barclaycard. Then you get things like vets, dentist, chiropody. If you want your ears syringed, you have to pay for that. Everything's going up.
Everything's going up. Just before I bring in Stacey, Roger, last question to you. A lot of governments, recent governments, whether Conservative or Labour, would say they've done their best to help and they have used a lot of public money to help people like you. Do you feel it's enough?
Not really. I think they should look at energy more for people, you know. And by the way, all this money we're paying for energy, what's happened to green energy? When's it coming on tack?
Well, I'll tell you what, Roger, we've got the energy secretary.
Finally, the daily rate. They're still charging a daily rate. They said they were going to absorb it into the unit rate.
Okay.
My bill last month was £56. £28 was the daily rate. I think that's unfair.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Roger, I'll put that to the energy secretary in just a moment. Let me bring in Stacey. Thank you to you, Roger, and best luck with all your work at that care home. Stacey, morning. Tell me a little bit about you, Stacey. Do you still work? Tell me a bit about your family life. Do you got kids, a partner?
Yeah, so it's me on my own. I live on my own with my two young children, 13 and 6. I recently used to work full time. I had to reduce my hours to part time because my dad's got really ill very quickly. Unfortunately, he passed away 9 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So I've kept this job going because obviously my daughter's still at school age where I have to take her to school and pick her up. And being a single parent, it's hard work, but I make it work and I make it manage.
Of course you do.
But I
was going to say, what's happening to your bills and what's happening with the food prices?
To be fair, it skyrocketed. I am noticing it more in food. I mean, obviously having a 13-year-old, you can imagine, he plays rugby as well. I played rugby as well, ladies rugby. So we're quite an active family. So as you can understand, with my 13-year-old, all he wants to do is eat. So it's like, you know, I'm having to keep trying to fill the fridge up and I'm trying to fill it up with healthy stuff. I mean, the strawberries alone, £3.85, I think it is, for a punnet of strawberries. And I'm like, that's barbaric.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm trying to keep it healthy and keep it clean, but it's becoming impossible. It's just everything's going up and I'm trying to think what can I drop to manage, and there's not a lot at the minute. And obviously we're working part-time. I'm to go down to probably 25-26 hours a week from 40. You know, I am feeling the pinch, but that's obviously down to me. But yeah, I am feeling the pinch, I'm not gonna lie.
Okay, can I just ask one final question? So are you getting into debts? Because it sounds like you don't have a huge amount of money left over at the end of the week.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm trying to get on the property ladder, I'm trying to get a mortgage, I'm trying to do everything I can to support my kids, so when I do eventually pass, my kids have got a future. But that's not even looking inevitable. It's not even looking correct yet at the minute. I can't do anything. I can't save. I'm trying so hard to save money. At the minute, it's just coming out. Everything's just coming out, and I'm left with literally pennies at the end.
Yeah.
And I am struggling.
Yeah, it comes in. Well, let me try and channel some of that to the Energy Secretary. Roger, Stacey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's say good morning to Miatta Fambula, the Energy Secretary. Ms Fambula, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
You heard there, as you will have heard from many of your constituents, and we've discussed it before, that things are incredibly tough. And in his first week, Mr Burnham said there will be this £45 annual cut in VAT on energy bills across the year. But this morning we hear that bills are going to rise by an average of 66%, and that's set by the regulator. Do you feel, in retrospect, you're not doing enough for people like Roger and Stacey?
Well, look, I think the first thing I'd say is we know that people are under huge amounts of pressure with the cost of living. And I know that people are really worried about their energy bills. And we are absolutely alongside them and are trying to do everything that we can. Look, that is why the Prime Minister on day one on the job put that cut to VAT on electricity bills, which will come into effect this October. But it's also why we're taking, you know, a set of measures to try and help people with the cost of living. The £2 cap on buses, free school meals that are being rolled out, free breakfast clubs, £8,000 savings on childcare costs. We're doing a set of things to help people get some breathing space. But look, we know that it is tough. We know families are under pressure. And if I think about energy in particular, for me, it exposes one of the things that we've been talking about. One of the problems that we've got is that we're very exposed to global fossil fuel markets that we have no control over, where if you have a conflict in the Middle East, it comes and it bites families' finances. And we're determined to fix that. That's why we're driving towards clean energy in order to make sure we've got homegrown clean energy here that can have an impact on bills, but critically, we're also trying to make sure that we're driving reforms across the system to make energy more affordable.
As you and I have discussed before in this programme, a lot of your opponents in politics and elsewhere would say that it's the drive towards net zero that is adding green levies to energy bills. And just to be clear, I want to invite you to engage with that. Is net zero costing people like Roger and Stacey more?
Well, absolutely not. And that's one of the misinformation.
Not through green levies?
So let me unpack it. If we think about the last 5 years, families have felt the pinch of energy at two points. The war in Ukraine and now the war in Middle East. And those are all a function of the fact that we are uniquely exposed to those gas markets. And that is why we've got to make the drive to have homegrown, clean, renewable energies. But look, the second thing we have is that candidly, for a decade and a half under the last government, we didn't invest in our energy system. We didn't invest in the grid. And we're going to have to deal with that. So for the grid to operate properly, we've got to upgrade it. My job is to make sure we do that in the fairest possible way for consumers. And we think about how we are protecting consumers so that we can ultimately get to a world where we're driving down bills. That's my number one priority. Energy is, as you know, as Roger and Stacey said, it's not a nice to have. It is absolutely essential to day-to-day life.
Okay, what
and
about,
so we need to make it more affordable.
Sorry to interrupt. What about his daily rate? Roger said that he's very angry, as you heard at the end, about the daily rate. He said it's £56. Half of that's a daily rate, £28. I want to ask you about the daily rate and the standing charges, this fixed daily fee, which can be about £315 a year. They are fixed costs. They do keep the lights on. Are they too high? Are you going to do something about it?
Yeah, so look, I know I've spoken to lots of people and standing charges are a massive bugbear and people are really frustrated by them. Look, the challenge that we have is that those costs, you know, they pay for things like upgrading and investing in our infrastructure. And so we've got to recover them in some way. Ofgem are looking at this. We're working with them to think about the most effective and the fairest way in which we recover that so that we are protecting consumers. So we're looking at that. But candidly, across the piece, you know, my number one priority, as I've said, is affordability and how we get this essential good affordable. So I'm looking across the piece at the set of things that we can do to drive down costs so that, you know, feeding your kids, putting the light on is something that is affordable for families and for businesses.
The TUC have an idea for you. They say tax the banks. Margaret Thatcher once imposed a windfall tax on banks. Very, very different circumstances, of course, different tax levels across the piece. Gordon Brown, who we spoke to an hour ago on this programme, once introduced a windfall tax on utilities. Are you looking at any sort of similar ideas, emergency taxes, windfall taxes on companies or utilities to try and raise funds to help with the cost of living?
Well, look, taxes, you know, is a question for the Chancellor. I don't think...
You're the Energy Secretary, for goodness sake. What a ridiculous thing to say. Come on. You're talking about affordability. What are you going to do?
I'm also trying to ingratiate myself to the Chancellor, and he will not... He will not appreciate me doing his job and preempting a set of decisions that he needs to make. But look, what I would say is we are already taxing the energy system. You know, we've got a set of taxes that ensures that we're, for example... excess profits are being made in the system, that is being taxed. But there is a fundamental issue that we have, which is if we want to fundamentally drive down bills, we've got to do the job of getting to clean homegrown energy, and we are racing towards that. £100 billion of investment has been unlocked. That's enough to power 23 million homes. But also, we've got to do the job of making sure that the energy system is fair for consumers, and I am committed to running at both those things.
Why would greater public ownership of energy reduce lower bills?
So we talk about public control. And I think, look, the way that I would explain it is that we've got this strange system at the moment where we've got a mixture of things that the government is doing to intervene in the energy market, to make it work, to regulate the energy market. And we also have private actors. I don't think that together that system is working for consumers. And if you, you know, speak to people across the country, and we heard it from Roger and Stacey, it doesn't really feel that the market's working for them. So we've got to think about, look, how do we ensure that we are getting different parts of the system to work in a way that is supporting consumers? We've done that on the retail with the energy price cap. Now that came in, and that's essentially saying, how do we manage and how we do control costs in the system? How do we ensure that if you're a retailer, we cap your profits so you're only making 2.4% rather than the big profits that were there before? And candidly, we're looking at every part of the energy system, networks, the wholesale, to ask ourselves the question, what can we do to make sure that the energy system is serving and working in the interest of consumers.
Miatta van Bulle, Energy Secretary, pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much.
It's 22 minutes past eight. Life is short. Keep your dreams big and your hair bigger. One of the most famous and utterly brilliant quips from Dolly Parton. I say one of the most famous, I can name about six of them this morning, and we have been throughout the programme. Dolly Parton is who we've been remembering, the country music legend, actor and philanthropist who has died, aged 80 in Nashville after what her publicist described as a brief battle with cancer. And it was to Nashville she went from the two-room log cabin in the grey Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee, where she'd grown up in abject poverty in a family of 12 children, to live permanently and make her name, aged 18, once she had finished school. Nashville was also where, on her first day in town, she met a man called Carl Dean, who would become her husband and her lifelong companion. She spent her life with him. He died last year. Fans have been gathering outside the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville.
I was shocked and devastated. She's my world. She meant so much to me and to so many of my friends and family and to the world. And there's nobody that could replace her, I don't think, ever.
We went for a tour of the Grand Ole Opry on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting, and if you've never been on a tour before, there's a place where you go and sit in a room, and there are these portraits that speak to you, and one of them is Dolly Parton. And my husband and I looked at each other, and we said, when Dolly goes, it's going to be tragic.
It's very sad for the country music world, for the whole everybody. I mean, she was just a total icon. It's very sad. She just was such a good person, and she just always wanted to be good. She never had anything bad to say about anybody. And I don't know, she was just an amazing lady. Always so positive. What she did with the children's books, and would send books out for kids, and she's just amazing.
Mention thereof, the Imagination Library we talked about earlier. Huge philanthropist, $1 million towards Moderna, one of the most successful COVID vaccines. She even changed the words to Jolene to vaccine. You may remember that. Amazing things. And also always ahead of the joke. If the joke was being made, she'd be in on it first, making it better than the person doing it. I didn't know until reading an obituary that even Dolly, the first cloned sheep, was named after her because it was made of mammary glands, and much was made of her mammaries. But above all else, Dolly Parton was a songwriter. You know, whether it's Jolene, I Will Always Love You, 9 to 5, many, many more. She wrote about people's lives and their hardest times. Her own favourite was Coat of Many Colours, which tells of how Dolly Parton's mother stitched together a coat made of rags given to the family.
My coat of many colours that my mama made for me, made only from rags, but I wore it so. As I could be in my coat of many colours my mama made for me.
Oh, we could just keep that playing, couldn't we? But I have to keep talking to you and want to because of who our next guests are, no less. Widely recognised as the UK's biggest country music act. We're joined now by The Shired, who were influenced, hugely influenced by Dolly Parton. Here's their cover of 1982's Islands in the Stream by Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers.
Islands in the stream, that is what we are. No one in between, how can we be wrong? Sail away with me to another world, and we rely on each other, from one love to another.
Ben Earle and Chrissy Rhodes join us now at The Shires, as you're known. Good morning.
Morning, Ella.
Good morning.
I'm sure lots of reflections going on. Chrissy, let me come to you first. The songwriting element of her life, that was everything, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that she's released as many songs and, you know, written those songs herself and, you know, so many albums, so much music for everybody to listen to. You know, I was raised, my gran raised me on Dolly Parton and all those songs, and she raised my mum on Dolly Parton. And I get that opportunity to raise my girls on Dolly Parton for all of those songs that she has recorded. And it's so tragic that she, you know, she has lost her life. And
what was it about those songs, though? You know, there'll be those who adore her and the whole idea of her, but they're not as familiar with the lyrics or the connections that you're talking about. Can you describe what it was for you?
Do you know what? I think what Dolly did was she had this stage persona who was such a performer and absolutely incredible. She wore all the most beautiful outfits and she had the big wigs, but behind the scenes of all of that, she had a very normal, you know, working class upbringing, you know, and her life is very different to what her stage persona was like, and she knew it. And I think she kept hold of that because she wanted to release songs that were for the working person. For She wanted to be relatable, and she was, you know, everybody could relate to her songs because we were all just like her, even though she had this like stage persona that was so very different and so larger than life. But the songs ultimately were the way that she was brought up, you know, and how important words were, you know, and describing her way of life.
And Ben, so many men feel this way about her as well. You know, yes, she was a woman's woman in that respect, but she wrote about all life and how life felt. And I suppose country music, it's a very special place to put that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I'm still devastated. I'm still so shocked, and I just didn't expect to hear it at all, the news. And it's actually funny when you talk about just the sort of just how gracious she was. That was the thing for me. There's an amazing clip. I'd urge anyone listening, if they can, to go and watch her performance on the Porter Wagoner show. And that was the show that really kind of broke her. Mm. And she ended up becoming bigger than the show. And when it was time to leave, she kind of said to Porter Wagoner, "Look, I've got to leave." And that's, there's a performance of I Will Always Love You, her first time she performed that on TV. And even a situation like that in a very male-dominated industry, she took ownership and really owned that moment, but in such a gracious and beautiful way. And
I'm not sure all the men were as gracious around her, were they, when she was making those sorts of decisions?
I can't speak to that at that time.
No. But some of the the reports about when, you know, when she was ready to move on, or saying no to Elvis when he wanted "I Will Always Love You." You know, she held her own and seemed to do so without making enemies, as it seemed as well.
Yeah, definitely. But like I say, it was the grace. I mean, also there's the Barbara Walters interview. I don't know if you've seen that one, when she really challenges her. And, you know, again, she holds her head up and, you know, has such grace in it. And she sort of carried that through her whole career. And like Chrissy said, I think having that such humble upbringing, if people haven't seen her home in the Smoky Mountains, I mean, it really, they were dirt poor, as she kind of describes herself. And I think, like Chrissy said, she never lost sight of that. She never forgot where she came from and who she was for all the, you know, the other stuff.
Yes. I mean, and, you know, you've been hugely influenced working as you are in your group, you know, widely recognised as the UK's biggest country music act, The Shires, if you're just joining us. But Chrissy, to come back to what she was singing about. I mean, she didn't shy away from stuff, did she? I mean, she was singing about adoption, abortion, women being put in mental institutions by husbands who cheated on them and driven them mad and they didn't want anymore, long before these were subjects you might even go near. And you know, lots of people won't go anywhere near them now.
Yeah, absolutely. They are very challenging to put into song. And, you know, massive respect to her for being able to give that voice to so many. And what would have been at the time, like those housewives that were relying on that kind of male income to come in to provide for their family. And she was that voice for them, and they could find comfort in her music. And, you know, they would have gone out to the store to buy her records, and it would have given them that hope that they needed. And I think that's what's so amazing about country music, that it can represent, you know, the working kind, the families that are, you know, the mothers that are at home. And she, you know, she really made sure, even though she didn't have children herself, you know, she considered everybody her family. And yeah, it's incredible what she's done.
Yes, and always in her own way. Chrissy Rhodes, Ben Earle, the duo behind, I should say, the Shires. Lovely to be able to hear how she influenced you and that impact through the music, remembering Dolly Parton. Thank you.
Coming up after the sports news with Mike, Emma's going to be speaking to the father of Chloe Moffat, a 26-year-old civil servant in the Treasury who tragically took her own life after her managers threatened her with a disciplinary hearing. David Moffat tells us he is still waiting for the Treasury to acknowledge their part in his daughter's death.
Yes, do stay with us for that. But for now, Mike is here with the latest on the sport. Hi again, Mike.
Hello, Emma. We are talking golf this hour because we have a special guest on the programme ahead of the start of the British Masters tomorrow. I've been speaking to Sir Nick Faldo, who's hosting the tournament, the six-time major winner. Always has plenty to say about the sport he has been involved with for 50 years now, including on the future of the controversial LIV Tour. We'll get to that in just a moment. But I started by asking Sir Nick for his memories of the course, which is once again hosting the British Masters, the Belfry.
Well, historic for us, you know, this is where the Ryder Cup, you know, we won in 1985. I was there. That was the start of the great European role. Winning in 85 and obviously winning in 87. What did we come back and tied in 89? And then we won another Ryder Cup in 95 and 97. So it was the start of European dominance. 30, 40 years later, it's still got the dominance going. So it not only saved the European Tour, but it's obviously then built it over the years.
So a lot of excitement then as we head into, as we say, the second half of the European golfing season. Need to ask you, though, Sir Nick, about the big story that has dominated the world of golf for the, well, past several years, really, but appears now to be coming to a head. That of LIV Golf, which as a tournament, as a concept, seems to be facing an uncertain future after the withdrawal of its Saudi funding. As a long-standing critic of LIV Golf, you are presumably welcoming the news that it might not be long.
Don't throw me under the bus. It was a breakaway group that for some reason thought, you know, that their opening line when I saw that, when they were going to supercharge the excitement of golf, I thought, well, good luck on that. Because, you know, I played my first Open 50 years ago. And over 50 years, what has stood the test of time? The majors and the Ryder Cup. Those are the biggest events in the world. Golf played with passion and everything. No gimmicks, no music, no shotgun starts, no 54 holes, none of that. Just proper golf. If you find that boring, fine, go and watch another sport. Golf is a fantastic game. I believe it's the toughest game in the world to play. But bottom line, it was too gimmicky. If they'd said it's going to be the world's greatest exhibition tour, well, you couldn't knock it. But to call it championship golf each Sunday when 35 people are watching, no, I'm sorry, I couldn't buy that. So, hey, the bottom line now, it looks like there's more players trying to leave LIV than actually want to join. Sounds like LIV 2.0 is not going to happen. It's highly unlikely they're even going to have enough players. I think golfers want to stay competitive. You have to have consequences in sport. They created a fail-free tour. No such thing in our game. You know, making the cut means something in our sport.
Just on the returning players, though, from LIV, these players who may now want to be leaving LIV Golf, Rory McIlroy said last week he doesn't think returning LIV players should be allowed immediately to re-enter the PGA or DP Tour. Do you go along with that?
I agree with that. I mean, if you have an exemption, i.e., If you've won a major, you would have a five-year exemption. But I just about everybody else, I'm sorry, you decided to leave one company and go to another company. Well, good luck coming back to that original company. That wouldn't happen in business, would it? I say they go back to the starting line. You can go and join the lesser tours and work your way up. If you're skilled and determined, you'll get your way back. Yeah, I agree with Roy. Shouldn't be handing out making life easy. It was a breakaway group, which for a while did damage the game. They thought the grass was greener the other side of the fence, and it wasn't. And so you've got to come back and start again at the bottom of the rung. And as I said, if you're talented and committed, you'll get your way back.
And just as a final point, Cynic, something completely different. I just want to ask you a little bit about social media and your own use of social media. As you say, you have been involved in the sport, the game of golf, for 50 years almost. Social media, iPhones, not really around in your playing days, but something that you, I've noticed, have really latched onto over the last few years. A quick look at your own Instagram page. I see you with your dogs. There's fishing videos on there. There's even a video of you cooking steak and eggs the other day.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I had a playing career, TV career, design career. Yeah, but it's good fun entertainment. It's good for me to keep the Faldo name. My career was it's half my lifetime ago. It's absolutely amazing how I can go fishing and climb through the bushes and 400,000 people watch me do something like that. So I'm doing it for entertainment. We actually genuinely enjoy it. But
how did those steak and eggs taste?
Oh, God, fabulous, of course. We got these chickens. Like, we can't keep them to stand still. 25 chickens. And we got the tiniest little eggs. It's so sweet. I did a 15 egg scrambled egg the other day between Lindsay and five dogs. We shared 15 eggs.
There you are, 15 egg omelette for two people. Sir Nick Faldo there. You can watch a video of him cooking steak and eggs on his social media channels.
I'll watch to do that.
You so wish, amongst many other things. He's got more important things to be focusing on over the next few days, as we say. He is hosting the British Masters at the Belfry, which get underway tomorrow.
Mike, always such a pleasure. Sideways is coming up later this morning with the details. Here is Matthew Syed.
How would you react if you were to discover that someone was trying to erase part of your history? That's exactly what happened to a remarkable woman named Vi, who's often called one of the godmothers of the leather and kink community. Today on Sideways, I'm exploring the many faces of erasure, from the deliberate destruction of books and histories to the private ways some of us come to erase parts of ourselves. Join me, Matthew Syed, for Sideways this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. The time is 22 minutes to 9. Keep it here with us on Radio 4. And now we can have a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Typical energy bills for millions of households in England, Scotland and Wales are to reach a three-year high from October after the regulator Ofgem announced an increase in the price cap. It's going up by 3.6%, which Ofgem says is rounded up to a headline figure of 4%, meaning bills for average homes not on fixed tariffs will rise by £60 a year. The Energy Secretary, Miatta Farnbulla, told us the government was rolling out a set of measures to help people with the cost of living. Flags across the United States are flying at half-mast following the death of Dolly Parton, the country music legend who died yesterday in Nashville at the age of 80 after what her publicist said was a brief battle with cancer. 14 babies have died in a fire that broke out in a hospital in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Local media said the fire started on the hospital's maternity ward after an air conditioning unit exploded. Senior doctors have told the BBC that the NHS is failing adults who seek help for mental health problems linked to sexual abuse in childhood. NHS England says specialist support is available and it's providing additional training for mental health teams.
Jane, thank you very much. It's 20 to 9. Bright, ambitious and happy. Those are the words that the family of Chloe Moffat used to describe their daughter, who died aged 26 after taking her own life last year. Chloe had worked at the Treasury for 3 years as a PA to one of the executive directors at the government department and was doing very well. Last May, without any warning, she was called into a meeting with two senior managers where she was told of allegations that she'd shared sensitive, confidential information about colleagues, which she denied. Chloe was then informed that no final decision had been taken as to how the allegations would be handled, but that it may be by way of a formal investigation or a disciplinary meeting. On asking if she would lose her job, she was told by one of the senior managers that they could not predict the outcome at this stage. Chloe left the office that day in deep distress, and despite talking to her friend and both of her parents who tried to give her reassurances, she was found dead after taking her own life at the family home in Surrey. At an inquest into Chloe's death earlier this month, Surrey Coroner's Court heard that the Treasury did not apply written disciplinary policy, which would have made it clear to her that if the allegations were proven, the likely penalty would have been a written warning, not dismissal. The coroner went on to conclude that the Treasury disciplinary process had materially contributed to her death. In the first broadcast interview with Chloe's father, David Moffat, since his daughter's death, he began by telling me what they knew about that meeting that Chloe had attended on that day.
Immediately after the meeting, she was in shock. Chloe went into a meeting, middle of the afternoon on a Monday, believing it as a one-to-one with her direct line manager. She turned up at that meeting, as she normally would. Chloe's first comment was, oh, this must be serious. There's two of you here. So that's the first time that she was aware of anything might be a to-do. And then they worked through and put several allegations to her that she'd shared confidential information.
And when she spoke to her mum, to your wife, Anne, you know, she was incredibly upset about this because, as I understand it, you tell me, straight afterwards, she was then locked out of email. There were changes straight after that meeting made, weren't there?
Processes that had obviously been put in place before the meeting or during the meeting, and that was all part of, I think, the shock and awe of it all for Chloe. What she had expected to be a one-to-one, I don't think she had had a difficult one-to-one meeting in her entire time at the Treasury. She was always perceived and seen as one of the top performers in their appraisal process. She always achieved top marks, incredibly well liked by both the people she worked with and the people that worked around her.
She was so upset, you know, the suggestion was made that she should come home her home outside of London, which she did. And you were there. And how did she seem?
She had composed herself in my eyes. She was still upset. We had a couple of conversations on what had gone on. She'd had more conversations with Anne. In essence, my first impression was, yes, yeah, she's upset, but she's working through it. And I think, do we blame ourselves? I'm sure there's a level of, yeah, well, I was there. Could I have done more? I'm sure I could have done more. During the meeting, she presented as being shocked, devastated and crying within the meeting with the two managers that were holding that meeting with her. She asked on several occasions if she could have a friend and if she would lose a job, both of which were denied her for different reasons. However, when she left that meeting, she walked out into what is quite a modern open plan office, packed a bag and walked out.
She denied the allegations, but if they had been proven, she wouldn't have lost a job. But she wasn't told that. It would have been a written warning. It wouldn't have been a dismissal. It wouldn't have affected any kind of promotion. But that wasn't told to her.
No. And even though she asked, that they said they could not determine the outcome, even though they could determine the outcome. I don't know if it's the managers that were advised badly by HR or HR just, or as the coroner's pointed out, didn't follow their own process and policy.
I know you also sort of had to turn detective after this. You're trying to check there was nothing you didn't know about her, whether it was debt, depression, yeah, drugs. And none of that, as I understand, came back with anything.
The big question was why. Obviously, we can't ask Chloe. We were aware that the meeting that Chloe had that afternoon, prior to Chloe taking her own life, but that's still a hell of a step. We did doubt ourselves, and we possibly wrongly doubted Chloe. Could there possibly be something that we weren't aware of as parents?
Now we live in an era where, because of data protection, you can't just say to somebody, so-and-so in the office has said that you've shared this information about them that you shouldn't have. Did you? You answer, yeah, yes or no, and, OK, well, we're going to sort this out now. You know, it sort of becomes very formal very quickly, doesn't it? Which can seem incredibly frightening, especially if you're young and you haven't done, you know, you're saying, I haven't done the thing that's been done, and then it's hanging over you and you don't know if you're going to face full humiliation, lose your job. And it is a terrifying prospect.
I think that's where Chloe found herself, exactly at that point.
Do you feel the Treasury have taken responsibility for its part?
Not yet. We did get a letter this morning from James Bowler, the Permanent Secretary. And again, very compassionate letter. We have met the Permanent Secretary, met him last August, following our level of frustration. We wrote to him as he had written a personal note to us directly following Chloe's death. And the footnote on that message to us was, if there's anything I can do, please reach out, which we did. I suppose the engagement by HMT improved tenfold. I wouldn't say with ourselves it improved, but certainly they chose to present witness statements where we've been informed prior to that meeting that HMT would engage with the coroner if it was seen that they had a case to answer.
There's a statement I have here from the Treasury which says, our deepest sympathies continue to be with Chloe's family and the department continues to mourn Chloe's death. We're taking all concerns extremely seriously and are considering the coroner's findings carefully. We have introduced improvements to guidance, support and wellbeing arrangements, but recognise we must continue to take action to prevent this happening again. What do you want to happen now? Are you going to take further action?
We don't know. The process with the coroner, we've only got positive things to say. We were treated with kindness, dignity and respect throughout the process, and we felt the coroner examined the evidence thoroughly and independently, listened to us. We challenged a number of things, and I think through that she heard Chloe's voice.
There must be a huge amount of anger once the full picture came into view.
One of the biggest challenges my wife Anne has is the anger that they just got it so wrong, so wrong.
I just wondered, had they ever cleared your daughter of the...
No, I'm not sure if they chose or if it wasn't appropriate, but the investigation didn't go any further. Not that there was anything to investigate, as we understand. The original concerns were raised. Those people that raised those concerns, we understand, always wanted to remain anonymous. So it couldn't have gone any further anyway. And I think that is the whole frustration of where we find ourselves.
Well, and the heartbreak, I mean...
Oh, it's just devastating. It hasn't torn us apart, but it's torn such a big hole in our lives for what can only, in our mind, it's still perceived as possibly office gossip, if that. A number of things have come out and none of them show HM Treasury and their HR department in a good light. We seek redress, just acknowledgement of what happened, and Treasury's part in that would go some way to helping us.
It must have also been to your own friends with their children a stark reminder to say to their own children, if they get into trouble at work or something, you know, wait, sit, you have to see what happens. Please don't jump to the worst conclusion.
One thing we've learned is that people, I don't think they should ever face workplace allegations alone. And I particularly young people. And I think Treasury is an organisation of young people from what I've read, what we've been told. It doesn't produce anything. HR should understand that the risks and the support they need. And I think on this occasion, their duty of care to Chloe was, there wasn't any duty of care. There was no safeguarding. There was no support during or after that meeting from what we've seen and what we've read. It beggars belief that an organisation that is front and central in our government cannot get it right. We can't change what happened to Chloe, but what we do want to ensure is that lessons are learned. If something positive can come from this unbearable loss that we're suffering, that's all we look to achieve.
David Moffat, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks, Emma.
David there in his first broadcast interview. And I should say, details of organisations offering information and support with some of the issues raised in this interview are available always at bbc.co.uk/actionline.
Time now is 10 to 9.
Food, school, children, a hot topic. Should we ban packed lunches at school? There are strong opinions on this and we must hear from those it affects. So we spoke to Asha, who's 9 years old, and Lyra, who's 13, to see what they think.
I have a disease called celiac and it's where I can't have wheat, couldn't have and lots of stuff. So normally, my mum makes my packed lunches. She puts really good stuff in that I can have. Mostly everybody in my class has packed lunches because people have got allergies and like really bad ones. The packed lunches look way better. I want to stick with packed lunches.
If you think of packed lunches, if they're having a chocolate bar every day, then it's not going to be very healthy having a chocolate bar every single day. Everyone would probably be like upset at first, but I think once they got used to like having the school meals, and they get at my secondary school, you get to pick what you get, so you get to be like a bit more independent. So I think overall it would be better in the long run if packed lunches was banned.
The ban. But here's what Amelie has to say, who is clearly not a fan of what's going on with the rotation of school meals where she is.
I wouldn't want school dinners every day because sometimes there aren't any good options except pizza and pasta, and I get quite bored of that every day. Pizza, pasta, pizza, pasta, pizza, pizza, pasta.
That could be a little photo. I mean, it sounds a bit like Brenda when she said, not another election. I did ask whether the school packed lunch should be out because from September, pupils in England, families on universal credit will be eligible for free school meals. And the expansion and provision is a significant moment. And our next guest has strong views. Dame Prue Leith, the chef, the food writer, broadcaster, of course, former judge on the Great British Bake Off. And I started by asking her, what is wrong with a school packed lunch?
I mean, it's understandable, isn't it? If you yourself don't eat particularly healthily and you like the food that you give your children and the children like it, they like chocolate bars and, you know, fatty puddings. And it's sort of natural to want to put a little bit of love into your school lunch for your children. You think, well, if there's a chocolate bar in there, the kid will think, oh, lovely mummy, she's giving me a chocolate bar. But, you know, you have to understand that that is absolutely disastrous for children because they just grow up eating the wrong food and they will be more unhealthy. They will not do so well at school. If they have a high sugar diet, they won't be able to concentrate properly. We just have to get to the mums as well.
And the dads, hopefully, at this point in time.
And the dads. Mums and the dads.
Even if that might be wishful thinking, I accept in certain homes still. But what is it from speaking to successive governments that still means that the school food can be incredibly unhealthy, unimaginative and beige? Because obviously a lot is made of cost pressures.
Yes, and often just not nice to eat, which is what drives children to beg their parents to give them packed lunches. But I'm really impressed because this is the first government in my 50 years of nagging and banging on doors and being a thorough nuisance to the Department of Education that a government has actually realised that it's important and that school children will do better if they're fed better. So they have quite sensibly decided not to allow schools to have to serve deep fried food, very sugary puddings, and to concentrate on fresh cooked from scratch food.
That won't be uniformly across the board, though. And I suppose the irony is if you say, let's get rid of packed lunches, a lot of people have done that because, yes, there may also be allergies, but because, yeah, they might sneak in a chocolate bar and there'll be those who are saying, oh, come on, Prue, it's just a treat. But they also do a much better and more varied diet for their children in that lunchbox than they can guarantee is going to happen at the school.
I don't think most packed lunches are all that healthy. But I'm not. I'm much more concerned about the lunches that are served in the schools. And I remember a school years ago who decided to ban packed lunches. There was a primary school, not more than about 200 students. But they actually got all the parents together. They had a massive meeting and they said, look, we can teach your children to love healthy food. And then they outlined all the benefits of health and progress and schoolwork and all the rest of it that would do. And what's more, you won't have to pack lunches. You won't have to have your children nagging you. Give it a go. And so the entire school agreed to have no packed lunches. And they did it, first of all, as an experiment for a term. And it worked so well that they still do that.
And that's where you think we should be going in this country. Just the irony is I'm about to ask you just a final question, if I may, about a programme that we know you for and, you know, many, many love, the Great British Bake Off. which is obviously not very healthy. I'm just thinking of some of the sweet treats we may have been inspired to make off the back of that. But the baton is going over to Nigella Lawson. How do you think she's going to do? Any words of advice you've offered?
She's so good. She's going to be fantastic. I saw her this week, actually, and she said she's a bit nervous, but actually they've finished filming the first one now and she's settled in and she absolutely loves it. And Paul loves her and everybody is as happy as anything, including Nigella. And I think the audience will adore her.
Well, I read that you're still very busy working and that means you don't always see your grandchildren. There's quite a strong headline of the day saying I'm not as good a granny or whatever it said. But I love the fact that you're still very, very busy, going strong. And thank you for talking to us on the programme this morning. Dame Prue Leith there, not mincing her words as we wouldn't expect her to. And over this year, I should tell you, we're going to be following a school in Manchester as the charity Chefs in Schools helps them reinvent those children's lunches.
9:04, we've got to end with Dolly Parton. She spoke to Frank Cottrell-Boyce on his special guest edit for this programme in 2024, and she told him about why she chose to turn her writing talents to children's books.
I love children. I'm from a family of 12. There's 8 kids younger than me, and I used to do a lot of reading and writing songs for them. Children have always related to me because I have kind of like that Mother Goose, larger-than-life Cinderella kind of persona. You know, with the big hair and kind of like fairy tale kind of stuff. And all these messages are things that I've learned through the years and that I wish I'd have had someone to help me with before I had to learn the hard way. So that's kind of what these little books are about. And then, of course, I have the Imagination Library where we give books to children. From the time they're born, they get a book once a month till they start school. So far, since we started that program 30 years ago, we've given away 250 million books. We're very proud of that.
Well, you may have heard Radio 2 DJ Joe Wiley earlier in the programme reminiscing about Dolly Parton's famous 2014 Glastonbury set. We thought we'd play out with the highlight of that afternoon, Jolene.
Are you having fun so far? This is a real thrill and a real treat. Now, how many of you go so far back that you'd remember a song of mine called Jolene?
Your voice is soft like summer rain. I cannot compete with you.